that she goes and says, I'm going to the ombudsman unless you can prove to me that you made it prominent and that this term is binding upon me. Thank you very much for your calls, texts and tweets this evening. That's it from me, consumer lawyer Dean Dunham. A quick reminder that the advice offered in this hour is for guidance only. You should always seek your own independent legal opinion. I'm off for the next two weekends, but I will be back on Sunday, the 19th of April. In the meantime, if you've missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at one, it's Richard Spur, but next here on LBC, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We will talk about the addictive nature of social media, as Keir Starmer says he is minded to do something about it affecting the nation's children. We will hear about the anti-far-right rally that took place in London yesterday. The local elections are weeks away. We'll look forward to those and talk about what they might mean for the party's leaders. We'll hear what the Pope has said, possibly aimed at Donald Trump. We'll check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. But first, what next for the war in Iran, as neither side look like backing down? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. Pakistan says it will be honoured to host and facilitate talks between Iran and the US looking to end the current war in the Middle East. Its foreign minister has announced they'll be taking place in the coming days, although there's been no immediate response from the two nations. The war is threatening global supplies of oil, natural gas and fertiliser. Guy Platton is the former Secretary General of the International Chamber of Shipping. He's been telling LBC shortages won't be immediate, but they could still develop.
Very few ships are actually passing through now, and only those ships are which are, I think, some sort of agreement has been made with the Iranians to allow them to pass through. But when you've got 20% of the oil supplies, you've got, I think, a third of the helium supplies and the other materials, it's a real choke point. So the supply chain is going to be disrupted in the weeks and months to come.
Earlier today, a leading Iranian official warned against a US ground invasion, saying its troops would be set on fire. The parliamentary speaker in Tehran says forces are waiting for the arrival of the Americans, following reports Washington was preparing for the possible deployment of ground troops. Tonight, air defense systems have been activated in the Iranian capital. Witnesses have reported heavy strikes on the city. A man's been shot dead while sitting in a car in central London. It happened near Euston Station at about 11 o'clock on Saturday night. Police say he was 26 and they're trying to identify the attacker. The Education Secretary says another 200 family hubs will open in England in the next week. The government hopes they'll save families hundreds of pounds by offering free advice and guidance, along with play sessions for children. Bridget Phillipson has been telling LBC it's similar to the old Sure Start scheme.
We're revitalising that for a new generation through Best Start Family Hubs. So that brings together parenting support, health support like midwifery and breastfeeding, but also access to family services like stay and play, things that will often cost parents money, which they often don't have.
And four astronauts are making their final preparations before becoming the first people to go to the moon in more than 50 years. They're currently quarantined in Florida. NASA is expected to launch the Artemis 2 mission no earlier than Wednesday. LBC weather, clear spells for many areas of England and Wales overnight, but showers will continue across northern England, Scotland and much of Northern Ireland. There'll be a low of around 3, mostly dry and clear for Monday morning, with sporadic showers continuing through northern England and parts of eastern and western Scotland. Breezy with a high tomorrow of around 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. As thousands of US Marines pour into the Middle East, officials say that the Pentagon is gearing up for ground operations in Iran, which they say could last several weeks. Insiders have described it as a major escalation, but not an all-out invasion, and suggest the use of special operations forces backed by infantry troops. The USS Tripoli arrived in the region on Friday, bringing an additional 3,500 sailors and Marines. Meanwhile, Trump is considering whether to send an additional 10,000 troops to the Middle East. Well, let's talk about all this with Air Vice Marshal Sean Bell, the former fighter pilot, now a military analyst. And he joins us on the line now. Air Vice Marshal Sean Bell, good evening.
Good evening, Nick. How are you?
Very well, thanks. 3,500 sailors and Marines, a possible more 10,000 troops. That's 13,500. Is that enough manpower to invade Iran?
Evidently not. If you look at the scale of the invasion of Iraq, Iraq was much smaller, close on 300,000 total. And of course, reports suggest there's up to 1 million Iranians under arms. So no, the short answer is no. What is interesting is that the US Marine Corps particularly is a formidable force. It's particularly good at doing these maritime type operations where going from sea to land. And as you reported, the Boxer and the Tripoli, two of their ships, are purpose-built for moving helicopter support and also fighter aircraft. They have F-35s on board. So it's very potent, but it's nothing like big enough to do, as you say, an invasion of Iran.
Well, what would be the purpose of sending them there then?
Well, I think there's two things here, one of which is that if you genuinely were planning to use them, then probably you'd be looking at either Karg Island, which is that little island about 200 miles north of the Straits of Hormuz, which is only strategically important because it's where Iran offloads most of its oil. It's a little island, it's in deeper water, and I think most of the ships that take the oil away from Iran, they use that. So that might be a strategic stranglehold. But the real test, I think, is the Straits of Hormuz is what America wants to open up. And I've worked in the military. When I was in there, we war game this sort of, and the only way really to guarantee the security of the Straits of Hormuz is to invade Iran and annex a whole area around the Straits of Hormuz to guarantee the safety. But in my judgment, I don't think those numbers of troops are remotely close to doing that.
Yeah, the Pentagon said that they have war gamed all of this. Well, that's true. They did. It was a war game called the Millennium Challenge in 2002. And in that game, the US versus Iran, Iran won.
Yeah, and it won't be betraying confidences, Nick, to know that when we ran it, I actually played the Iranian side for a couple of the runs through this. And although the American military completely dominated the Iranian military and literally pulverized it, it still left Iran in control of the Straits of Hormuz. And bluntly, they've had 35 years to prepare for this since the last of the sort of tanker wars. And that's why most of the kit and equipment they've got is underground. It's just a threat of action that actually stops these oil tankers being insurable. And I suspect what if going full circle, one of the reasons why America is sent these troops in is because it looks very much like President Trump's looking for an off-ramp at the moment. He loves to do a deal, and you've got to have leverage if you're going to do a deal. Well, actually, by at least deploying troops, it looks as if there might be some credibility to his threat to invade. And it might just sow a seed of doubt into the Iranian leadership's mind that he just might do it. That might give him some leverage, and that might be why he's doing this whole escapade.
Well, having played Iran in that war game, do you think that that's at all likely that it will sow a seed of doubt in the Iranian regime?
Well, bluntly, both sides probably want to see this war end. I don't think the Iranian leadership want this to continue, because the more it pounds away, the more they risk losing their lives, the more there is the risk that they actually don't have a future, and their survival is, the regime's survival is ultimately the number one priority. I think this is all about the negotiations at the end, whereas President Trump has been declaring victory from day one and almost expecting a surrender. It's no coincidence that the when President Trump issued that 15-point peace plan, which did look like a surrender plan, Iran immediately put their own plan on the table, a 5-point plan, neither of which is going to be acceptable. And I suspect, like every conflict in history, eventually it's going to have to be negotiated. Once you can get the egos out of the way, they'll have to sit around a table, and then it's all about leverage. And therefore, I think both sides will want to get this to an end. The real question is, under what terms?
Yes, but the extraordinary thing is, Iran seems to be the player, if I can put it that way, that has done all the planning. Donald Trump, on the face of it, looks as though he's just winging it.
Unfortunately, Nick, I would come to exactly the same conclusion. The American military are formidable. I've worked and trained with them before. They will have done all of this wargaming. So you have to assume that President Trump was given a very fulsome brief about the implications of this. But therefore, you'd have to conclude that Trump went into Venezuela and plucked Maduro out. And, you know, that all happened pretty without a loss of life, or at least on the American side. And it sounds like he's decided that if he did the same with the Iranian leadership, literally killed the Ayatollah and all the seniors, within 24 hours there'd be an uprising and he wouldn't need to worry. He's got his regime changed. Well, unfortunately, I suspect the military knew full well this wasn't going to happen. And now it feels like President Trump's got his hands firmly in the mangle. And this is the war is getting worse. It's not getting to an end state.
Do you think that he's aware of that? Because, I mean, there's all sorts of reports coming out that he spends his time looking at what they call war porn, which are just video clips of stuff blowing up, and that he surrounds himself with people who are petrified of telling him something he doesn't want to hear, or petrified of telling him something he hasn't already said. And so, do you think he's sort of living in a world of make-believe, that he just sort of constructs these ideas that he's winning the war, and by force of personality, he assumes that he can make it so?
Nick, I really hope that's not true. I really hope that the leader of the free world doesn't actually believe that he can run wars like this just through instinct, because as this gets worse, you know, he's claimed victory, I think it was on day two. And yet there was this attack on the Prince Sultan Air Base yesterday, which is a US military. The headlines were that 12 US servicemen were injured too seriously. But the harsh reality was, we think that three of their major tankers were destroyed. That demonstrates that Iran, far from being destroyed, is still able to conduct surgical strikes. They're not finished yet militarily. And one would assume at the moment, given that they've got a stronghold over the Straits of Hormuz, now the Houthis are getting involved and starting to put pressure on the Bab al-Mandab Straits, this is actually spiralling a little bit out of control. President Trump eventually is going to have to see sense and work out what the off-ramp is. That's becoming increasingly difficult to see how that will happen.
Yes, and increasingly difficult to understand who is going to break the bad news to him, because there doesn't seem to be any strategy at all, or any sort of clear thinking about any of it. First, he obliterated Iran's nuclear project, in his words, obliterated, and then it wasn't obliterated, and he needed to re-obliterate it. And then he'd won the war, and then he didn't need our help, and then the war wasn't won, and he did need our help. And then Iran was begging to make a deal, and then they needed to be bombed into surrendering to make a deal. It's just all over the map. If it wasn't so serious, it'd be funny.
No, I agree with you, Nick. And I've been a veteran of several campaigns over the years, and it's one of the reasons as a talking head for the Ministry of Defence, I try and help, you know, us understand what's going on. And I am struggling, because the President Trump effect, one of his strengths, I suspect, is his unpredictability. The problem is, I wonder whether history books will be written about this chapter, that the president who got elected on the altar of bringing peace, solving lots of wars, and promising never to get involved in enduring wars, has actually got himself involved in one of the biggest. And it's very difficult to see how this is going to unwind anytime soon.
Yes, I mean, you mentioned the Suez Canal, or at least the waterway up to it.
The Bab al-Mandab Straits.
Yes,
yeah.
I mean, if that closes as well as the Strait of Hormuz, well, that's just going to pretty much bring the entire economy of the world to a standstill.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the Straits of Hormuz is about 15% of global sort of oil and gas. And if you look at the Bab al-Mandab, it's about 15% of global shipping goes through there. Now, bear in mind that the reason the Red Sea is used is obviously you've got the Suez Canal at the north of it. It doesn't stop shipping going a long way round, but it adds, you know, several days to the transit and a bit more cost. So it's not the end of the world. It will just add a bit more time. The challenge, of course, for the Straits of Hormuz is there's no other way out of it. So, you know, all the shipping has to go past that, and it's quite narrow. It makes it relatively easy for the Iranians to target ships. And as I said, they've managed to develop a whole series of anti-ship missiles. Bizarrely, they've been provided by China. In return, China's done an oil for weapons deal. So it is Chinese tankers that are still making their way through the Straits of Hormuz. So it's slightly more complicated than just the Iranians, but they are prepared for a long haul here. And that's not something that President Trump will have an appetite for.
Yes, it's a particularly difficult foe, isn't it, Iran? Because they don't actually need any weaponry at all. They just need the threat of a weapon to blow up the odd ship. And as you suggested, insurers will balk at insuring any boat that's going to negotiate that strait. And the traffic will be brought to a halt, whether they have the weaponry to do it or not.
Yes, and I mean, I think sort of the other intriguing bit of this is I'm no maritime expert, but I understood that normally it was about 0.2% was your insurance premium. So for a ship that's, you know, full of $100 million of oil, it's about $200,000 to insure it. Well, at the moment, the insurance premiums are at 7%, so it's about $7 million to insure. So Iranians are just saying, well, we're going to charge a $3.5 million tariff for you to go through the straits. And of course, desperate people are doing that. So Iran is able to profit from this whole situation, but it's not going to solve any time. They've frequently, Iran has turned around and said, the straits are not closed. They're open to our friends. They're closed to our enemies.
Yes, Russia is also profiting from this, isn't it? Because the price of oil is going up. That is what Russia, the Russian economy, depends on, over and above the actual war effort. Is it entirely coincidental that Donald Trump's actions is benefiting Vladimir Putin?
Well, I'm not a great believer in conspiracy theories, but I think the thing that will have frustrated Western leaders immensely is that they recognize that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is an existential crisis for Europe. They don't want to get directly involved. So one of the ways of doing it is to try to cripple the Russian economy, put lots and lots of sanctions on and drive the price of oil down. So that, and that seems to have been working. But as soon as Trump decided, therefore, to lift the sanctions, my understanding is that Putin is making $150 million a day more, and that is simply going to extend the war. In addition to that, if you only have to look at the amount of ordnance weapons that are being expended in the war in Iran and the number of air defense missiles that are now being used up, and by all accounts, we're running out, that means Ukraine is going to have less weapons sent to it. There are fewer missiles, fewer bombs going to be available, all of which will embolden Russia. And the final bit, frankly, is that the world criticized Russia for invading Ukraine, a sovereign country, particularly when Russia is a member of the UN Security Council. Well, when America, leader of the free world, suddenly goes in and does that in Venezuela and then attacks Iran, it's not entirely clear to anybody what the legal status of that is yet. How on earth can anybody criticize Russia for going to Ukraine? All these things will embolden President Putin, and that's a dangerous place to be.
What do you make of the reports that Donald Trump is taking the weaponry that was bought by NATO countries, us included, for the use in Ukraine, and because America is chewing through its own weapons at an alarming rate, he's taking the weapons that were to be sent to Ukraine, us having bought them, and using them for his own needs in Iran?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the facts behind this. Inevitably, what is very clear is President Trump will be putting American interests first. And it's pretty clear that those interests do not lie with Ukraine and Russia. He's pretty clear that that war is on the European continent. It's for Europe to deal with. And therefore, whether we've actually bought them and they've been stopped en route, who knows? But there's no doubt that the missiles You only have to do the maths. When the war in Iran started, Iran probably had more ballistic missiles than America had missiles to shoot them out of the sky. And that's one of the reasons why probably the military plan would have tried to strike the Iranian missile launchers and the storage areas to try to limit the number that could actually fly towards bases. But even so, when you look at all of the missiles being fired across the region, particularly probably some were wasted firing at drones rather than the ballistic missiles, it doesn't surprise me that the stocks will be running low and President Trump's priority will not be Ukraine.
Yeah, you're a flyer. You know about the war from the air. The US and Israel boast of hitting 15,000 targets in Iran. What we don't know very much is what kind of targets they are. Do you think that the targeting of those 15,000 sites is based on the same data that led to, at the very beginning of this, a girls' school being blown up?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're conflating a couple of things here. I mean, there is no excuse for blowing a girls' school up. I mean, there'll have to be some form of inquiry there. The surgical weapons precision strike relies on good data, and only America will know what's happening there. For me, the bigger question here is, if you're not going to put boots on the ground, can air power alone deliver the objectives that America wants? One of those was regime change. Well, evidently, it's not going to do that. Second one was to stop Iran ever developing its own nuclear weapons. Well, you can set back their programs by days, weeks, months, maybe even years. But if they still have the intent to build nuclear weapons, you're not going to stop that with an airborne campaign. You're going to have to stop that with negotiations. Create a carrot and stick negotiation where Iran sees it's in their best interest not to pursue a nuclear weapon because it's better for their country. And at the moment, it feels to me, all the focus on a military campaign is completely missing the point. America will undoubtedly claim success in their military campaign, but whether they will achieve the strategic objectives of this war through military means alone, I think is very unlikely.
Very good to talk to you, Sean. Thanks so much for your time. That's Air Vice Marshal Sean Bell, former fighter pilot, now military analyst. So, how do you think it's going so far? 0345-6060-973. We're going to be talking about Keir Starmer, various issues, and of course, his approach to this has caused some consternation in certain parts and a certain amount of relief in others. So there's many aspects about this to talk about. The number is 0345-6060-973.
LBC. Hi, I'm Sava, founder of Cool You, the daddy of air conditioning. For over 15 years, Cool You have specialised in installing our fully internal aircon systems throughout London, with no mess, no fuss, and no external condenser. And from April the 10th to the 19th, come and meet me and the team at the Ideal Home Show, London Olympia. Daddy cool. Cool You, for a cool, comfortable home.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low, slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny.
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. If you are a landlord and you have existing tenants, you must send them a copy of the government's information sheet by the 31st of May, or risk a fine. Find out more at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Yes, we're talking about the war in Iran, which so far we seem to be skirting, but only just, and only really because of the reluctance of our Prime Minister to do Trump's bidding. Were we under the leadership of another party, perhaps we'd be in it already. 0345-6060-973. Enfield. Hello, Peter.
Good evening, Nick.
Peter.
You can't really disagree with much what Sean says, can you?
I couldn't.
but you opened asking the question, what would happen if either side backed down? And my immediate query on that is, it looked like if Iran backed down. Ow.
Could you expand on that? What do you mean?
But, I mean, I haven't got a clue how they could back down. It's all really in Trump's hands, that but by the same token, America might have to win, but all Iran has to do is not lose.
Well, I think what America might do, and this is what I suspect might happen, is that Donald Trump will claim that he's won, and then what happens thereafter? Well, we'll find out when we get there, I suppose. But I don't think he knows what winning actually looks like. I mean, if it looks like repeating the success of the deal that Iran did have with the West before Donald Trump tore it up,
then,
exactly. He tore up the deal that Iran had signed to restrict its nuclear program, and it had Barack Obama's signature on it. And Donald Trump has been adamant and very systematic about tearing up anything that had a Barack Obama's signature on. And he appears to want to go back to the deal that he tore up, but with his own signature on it. And if that's actually the real reason that all of this is happening, well, then I'm not sure that
I'd certainly
history,
take that.
Yes. Okay, good talking to you, Peter. Thanks for that. Gareth says, I hate to break it to people, but if you've been listening closely to those around Trump for the past 12 months, you will definitely realise that they're all working to the mantra, if the president says it's so, then it is, no matter how ridiculous or outlandish it may seem. Yes, well, he is saying ridiculous and outlandish things. I mean, apart from anything else, he keeps attacking countries who are normally America's allies. I mean, he's been belittling our country night and day. He says Saudi Arabia's ruler should be kissing his arse, which is presidential language now, apparently. He talks down France. He openly threatens other countries in the West, while at the same time demanding our help. I mean, can we write this off, like so much of what he says, as, oh, well, it's just Donald Trump being Donald Trump? Or is he actually really losing it? Clapham. Hello, Maria.
Oh, good evening, Nick.
Maria.
Yeah, basically, I mean, I wrote to you very... I just find it that it's very convenient, yeah. I mean, considering everything and taking the history and how friendly this man is with Mr. Putin, I just find it very suspicious, or very convenient, I should say, that all this is going. In the meantime, the West is expending, we're wasting all our arsenal on this war, yeah, while Russia, like I've just heard, is making money fist over hand, yeah, building a formidable arsenal, and yet we're too busy fighting a war which we don't know about, or the West is trying, or this man is trying to drag us into a war, and we're just wasting everything we have to defend ourselves. In the meantime, Russia are rebuilding.
It does seem curious, you could use the word suspicious, that Donald Trump's actions do seem to coincide with what Vladimir Putin would have wanted him to do.
I mean, like oil, for instance. Now Russia is the one that, you know, he suddenly, you know, allowed them to start selling oil, you know, while before we had a stranglehold on them. And then all of a sudden, when this war started, wow, look, the pipes are open again. What's going on, Nick?
And the weaponry that we are buying as part of the NATO force that was going to be sent to Ukraine is now being repurposed for Donald Trump's Iranian excursion.
Thank you. What's going on? I just find the whole thing is really sort of like,
Yes, exactly. All right, thanks a lot, Maria. Helen in Lancashire says, the term off-ramp is new to me. I suppose the term slip road doesn't sound as good. Trump is careering all over the freeway with daft decisions. He's driven towards tragic results regarding this war. It goes to show running a business is a different animal to running America. Well, given that most of the businesses that Donald Trump started were run into the ground by the same Donald Trump, failure after failure after failure, then I think, as far as he is concerned, running a business is exactly the same as running America. Doesn't seem to be a runaway success. Not so far. Bridge End. Hello, Bo.
Hiya, Nick. Nick, this insane war. This is insane. Let's think of where we were a month ago, Nick. And the streets of Hormuz are closed, okay? Because mines don't distinguish between friendly ships and enemy ships. Mm-hmm. They closed. They were open a month ago, and negotiations were going on. Okay.
Yes, a month ago, none of us were experts on the Strait of Hormuz, and now we all know about it.
Yeah, but I tell you what, the Iranians have had like 20, 30 years since to sort it out. They've got so much underground. And remember, the threat against insurance companies and ships is all they need. And they've got stuff buried underground. So unless the Yangs put troops in on the ground, the Straits of Hormuz will remain closed. So it's as simple as that.
Well, Trump is threatening Iran with, as far as I know, 1,300 troops. 13,000. No, not 13,000. Yeah, it's about 13,000 troops, something like that. Up against a force of a million or so.
They can call a million to arms, which I think has been credibly. I didn't think it was that many, so I looked. But there are. It's credible.
It's a big country. It's as big as much of, like France, Spain, Germany, combined, I think. 90 million people.
Where do you think Britain and Europe goes now? Because under Trump's threats, he's going to threaten us with whatever to join in this insanity.
He's already done that. Yes, he's already said he's going to remember, and all sorts of threats are coming out. Because he understands that he's gotten himself into a position that presumably the people around him told him what he wanted to hear, which is he was, huge and tremendous and strong, and that this was going to be over in the blink of an eye. And if telling somebody what they want to hear is not necessarily a good policy if a war will come of it. And I imagine that his threats now towards us in particular are the slow realization that he's gotten himself into something that is not as easy as he was led to believe it would be. All right, good talking to you both. Thanks for that. More of your thoughts on this in this hour, 0345-6060-973. I'm going to take a break for the news. Immediately after that, though, there was a big, big march in London yesterday. I'm going to be talking to two of the people who were on that march. It's 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Pakistan says it will be honoured to host and facilitate talks between Iran and the US looking to end the current war in the Middle East. Its foreign minister has announced they'll be taking place in the coming days, although there's been no immediate response from both nations. Air defence systems have been activated in the Iranian capital this evening. Witnesses have been reporting heavy strikes on Tehran. And a man's been shot dead while sitting in a car in central London. It happened near Euston Station at about 11 o'clock on Saturday night. LBC weather, clear spells for many areas of England and Wales overnight, but there will be showers continuing across northern England, Scotland and much of Northern Ireland. There'll be a low of around 3 degrees.
This is LBC.
Wellness. What even is wellness? Cleanses, routines, regimes, biohacks, stacks, schedules, procedures, programs. I suppose so. But can it just be a cup of... Pukka Herbal Tea. Ah, Pukka. Nothing beats nature.
Think of a date that's special to you. Now imagine if that date won you a life-changing £1 million. Every week with a birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1, or via post. Enter by midnight tonight, and your special date could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only, no purchase necessary.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Many people gathered in London to march against the far right in what is being described as the biggest multicultural demonstration in the history of this country. Organisers claimed a significantly larger number of people attended in the capital for the Saturday Together Alliance March. The police estimated a somewhat smaller number. Let's talk about this with Monica Patel, a Green Party candidate in South Woodford, and Tia Kofi, the Drag Race UK winner, who was also at the march. Let me come to you first, Monica. The organisers said 500,000 people turned up for the march. The police said 50,000. That's quite a discrepancy. Which figure did it seem to be closer to you?
Definitely the 500,000, just being there, seeing things. The fact that they delayed our start time as well just shows us that there were just more people than they probably anticipated. And I think the police figure is definitely an underestimate. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anyone can just see the footage that's online on social media and just see with their own eyes whether or not the police figures were correct.
The police figures are usually lower than the organiser of any event suggests, but I can't remember them being 10% of what the organisers suggest. That's a bit strange, isn't it?
It is strange. I was also quite shocked by that too, because I always know that the police figures are lower than you'd expect, but that underestimate was quite startling. I don't really know how they work out their figures and where they got that number from, so you'll have to ask them, I'm afraid.
So what was the intention of this rally? What was the purpose of it?
Yeah, so the intention was just to have a kind of alliance, loads of people together, show solidarity, show community against the rise of the far right. Obviously, there was the Tommy Robinson march that happened a few weeks ago, and that had quite a big turnout. And I guess what we wanted to do was have a response to that and just have an opportunity to show up and show the value that we support, which is like togetherness, unity, support for all sorts of different people in our society. You know, people are welcome here no matter what their backgrounds. And it was just such a beautiful opportunity to be able to actually get together with lots of different people and show this is what we believe in, this is what we stand for.
Tia, how was the march for you? What was the atmosphere like?
I thought it was amazing. I mean, there were so many people who turned up from such different groups, all sort of representing one ideal, which was unity, and exactly what Monica was saying, that sense of coming together as a country.
The sense I got from the right-wing march in September last was that the people there were tightly defined demographically. So what you're suggesting is that the complete opposite was the case yesterday.
I mean, it was incredibly diverse. There were people from all different walks of life, from all different organisations, and lots of groups sort of represented, which is incredible to see, because I think that's really what it is to be British, is sort of like embracing and including people no matter where they come from, no matter what their background is.
Monica, the right-wing get their minority voice amplified through the right-wing press and through the outrage-farming algorithms of social media, don't they? Is part of the value of a gathering like this to counter the feeling that just because they shout the loudest, the far-right aren't the majority?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Meetings, these big protests, these demonstrations, they just allow people to, I guess, essentially go outside and touch grass and see that despite what you might see amplified by algorithms online, actually the reality on the ground, in real life with real people, is we don't agree with this. We don't agree with their messaging, and we actually all stand together, and we're a lot bigger and we're a lot more diverse than maybe it might seem if you're just paying attention to your narrow part of the internet.
Yeah, Tia, I felt that there was a difference, not just in the makeup of the people there, but also in the message that came from the stage. On the right-wing rally in September, it was full of angry talk of invasion, of fighting, aggression, of being apart. Yesterday sounded more optimistic, more of a feeling of togetherness. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the overarching message is that hope really trumps hate. As Monica was saying, I think a lot of the time the voice of sort of like negativity and hate can be so loud, particularly on social media and in the media. And yesterday it was sort of this coming together of people who were really speaking with love, with the idea of embracing one another emotionally and spiritually, and also just having hope for the future of the UK.
What about the speakers from the stage? Who really piqued your interest?
Well, I will say, because there were so many people, many more people than the Met would have you believe, we didn't make it to the stage on time because the start time of the walk was so sort of delayed. But I was very excited to see such a range of people there. Had I been there, I would have loved to have seen what Zach had to say. Obviously, Zach Polansky has been speaking a lot and speaking very firmly about embracing hope and not hate. And also, who doesn't love Leanne Pinnock from Little Mix showing up and representing? Love her.
What did you make of Zach's speech, Monica?
I also never got to actually see the speech because we were so far behind. The march was so big, they delayed our start time, like I said. So I missed it as well, which was a shame. But it's okay. Like Tia said, there were like good vibes. People were like dancing. There was music. It just feels so lovely and so hopeful. So I'm glad I was there for that bit.
How has he managed to fashion the Green Party into such a political force? Because not too long ago, they were the 4% party.
That's a really good question. I think that's just because the Green Party policies are policies that people agree with, that people can get behind. Zach is just, I guess, the sort of mouthpiece or the representative of the Green Party. And I think people are finally waking up to the fact that actually the Greens have a really strong chance of winning. They can make a difference. And people are just looking for a political alternative to what we've already had for years and years. So I think it makes absolute sense that the Green Party is now like in a position where people are waking up and paying attention. And I do also think, you know, Zach's leadership has been great. He really does communicate our message well for us, and people are like into it. They're into it. They're interested.
Do you think that part of it is that he's sort of taken the Green Party beyond what you would ordinarily have thought that they were all about, you know, eco issues and things like that? And it's now much more, it's a party that has more broad interest.
The Green Party, good question. Yeah, I personally feel like the Green Party has always been a party with like broad interests. So I guess, yeah, Zach has finally got the messaging out there for us. That is the case, and I think that's wonderful that more people can finally see what the Green Party are about.
Tia, you mentioned one celebrity and the fact that you didn't, the march was held up so you didn't get to see them. But do you think that the participation of celebrities actually helps, or is it... Because I remember that Kamala Harris, when she was running for president... She had the support of some of the biggest celebrities in the world, and she lost to a man who could barely fill a car with his celebrity endorsers.
I mean, that's a fair point. It doesn't necessarily mean it will be the case here. I think a lot of people with big platforms have lent their platforms to this sort of movement because it is one that is founded in positivity and it is sort of counteracting a lot of the voices that you might hear on the other side of the aisle, which are very much full of negativity and fear-mongering and really just making people feel scared. This is all about hope, and this is all about having momentum towards the future and uplifting sort of positive voices, really.
Well, Monica, let me ask you about the momentum, because Reform certainly does have it. I mean, not Reform. The Green Party has momentum. Reform support peaked last September at about 33%. Now it's 25% and seems to be on a downward trajectory. The Greens, in the same period, went from 12 to 20 and continue to go up. Do you think Reform have lost momentum and the Greens are potentially, at this rate, going to overtake them?
Yeah, definitely. The trajectory looks really positive. I think what people are waking up to is just, well, I think support for kind of any party outside the two traditional parties that have often kind of had power is because people are sick of the two traditional parties and they want change. And people are like looking at their options. And I think what's happening now is people are seeing that actually the Greens are the better option, and that's where they're moving towards. That makes perfect sense to me.
Okay, very good to talk to you both. Thanks so much for that. That's Tia Kofi, Drag Race UK winner and an activist who was at the march yesterday, as was Monica Patel, the Green Party candidate in South Woodford. Now we're going to take thanks so much, both of you. We're going to take a short break and then come back with more of your thoughts on what is happening in Iran and what part of it we should be playing in this country. 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
A defenceless defense secretary all at sea over the numbers.
We have
We have we have 17 frigates and destroyers.
But next week, it's issues closer to home with the business of business rates.
We are putting in a number of reliefs for hospitality. We're doing so in a way that is progressive.
And as hospitality firms prepare for rocketing costs in awful April...
It's a particularly challenging time at the moment. It's why the government needs to prioritise supporting this sector.
Is it now last orders for a sector crying out for help?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or... the LBC app.
And now your travel news. It's starting to look a bit congested on the A4872 southbound. We're hearing reports people are slowing down to look at the Volkswagen Transporter sales event. Apparently you can get £1,500 off any new Transporter. That's any variant, any trim, and any colour until the 31st of March. Now that's a deal worth queuing for. Search VW Transporter offers. UK retail customers 18 plus. Discount applies to price of all new Transporters ordered by 31st of March and delivered by 30th of June.
It's not easy being a clamp stuck on the wheel of the one person on the street who didn't tax their car. Yeah, Graham at number 7, I'm talking about you. Bet the neighbourhood group chat is as well. Wish I had a group chat. Maybe I can chat to myself.
Hi Clampy, how's it going?
Not great, Clampy. Being clamped to the only untax car for miles is so lonely.
Over 98% of drivers tax their vehicle on time. Tax it. Don't risk it. Visit gov.uk/DVLA/taxit.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Yes, we're talking about the Iran war. Ron says Trump can't claim that he's won if the straits are still closed. Yes, that's right. And I think that Trump will want to declare victory very soon. And if Iran isn't going to play along, then he's going to have to do something about it. Trump will. Because if the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, and it gets worse than that, and the Suez Canal is closed, well, that's going to grind the world's economy to a standstill, because oil is in everything. I bet you're touching something that was made with oil right now. It's in medicines, it's in plastics, it basically is the makings of the modern world. But there's also helium, which is needed for computer chips, which are also in everything. They're in your phone, they're in your car, they're in traffic lights, everything. And fertilizer, the lack of which could cause mass starvation. So Donald Trump appears to have put the entire world at the mercy of the Iranian regime. 0345 6060 973. Hackney. Hello, Henry.
Hello. Good evening. Can you hear me?
Henry, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I just pulled up to this. I want to tell a little story about. So I can kind of hear the radio in the background. I don't know if that's something. But basically, the CIA, the Mossad director David Barnea had an assessment that killing Ayatollah Khomeini would enable Mossad to effectively galvanize opposition to the regime upon his death. Mm. The CIA actually had a counter position on that, but then ironically, obviously, as they invaded Iran, the Ayatollah was killed in Israeli strike. Alongside the Ayatollah, obviously, you had the his wife, his daughter, and his grandchildren. Now his son has now taken over, and the idea that killing the Pope on Lent, the equivalent of killing the Pope on Lent, because he was obviously killed during Ramadan, and then putting his son in power, who is, you know, way more ideologically less moderate than his father, cut his teeth in the IRGC in one of their most elite radical battalions. It is effectively, laughable that it's going to lead to a kind of like de-escalation and capitulation of the country. In fact, they're more radicalized and more hardline than ever, and they seek to basically fight to the bitter end.
Well, I suppose the thinking was that if there's 90 million people in Iran, most of whom are reportedly dissatisfied, to put it mildly, with living under this regime,
sure,
that it would persuade those people to rise up and do the right thing. But it's very difficult to do that if, when some of your numbers did it the previous week, they were mown down in the street by men with machine guns.
Yeah, of course, and I think there probably was, you know, likely real dissatisfaction with the regime. But I tell you what, in the opening salvos of a war, you know, blowing up a girls' school, killing 150 school children, anybody that was thinking, you know, I really hate this regime, but now they're, you know, committing, you know, mass strikes all around the country. I think we've learned from history that that does not. That does not galvanize sympathy for the people who are dropping the bombs. In fact, it hardens and radicalizes people.
Of course. If another country hit 15,000 targets by bombing them from the air in this country, would we just shrug it off and say, oh, well, you know, we were probably behaving quite badly before and we had it coming. Now let's talk peace. Of course we wouldn't.
Well, absolutely. And you know, I've been kind of like, I mentioned to your colleague, you know, I studied both undergraduate and master's kind of political science, but Middle Eastern studies was a big part of that. And I actually got a few of my friends to invest in crude oil before the actual initial salvos began. And we've all done quite well from it and feeling a little bit guilty about it. But going into that specific point and looking at the situation on Karg Island or the Strait of Hormuz, we are now at a point where, and obviously I don't know if you noticed, the Houthis have entered the chat. Mm-hmm. So we now have the Houthis potentially cutting off Saudi's ability to sell oil through the Red Sea, which at the end of the day was a drop in the ocean compared to the 20 million net barrels per day that was coming through the Strait of Hormuz and from the Gulf states.
Yeah.
The next plan is to obviously land two marine battalions and the 82nd Airborne to take Karg Island. While simultaneously, obviously, not damaging the infrastructure that exists on said island, so we can then, you know, continue to allow the supply to continue. Do you think this radical hardline becoming increasingly a total war economy of Iran? Do you think they're just going to allow the Marines will take it militarily? Don't get me wrong, but will they just allow the US to take control of that all of that oil infrastructure?
Well, taking something militarily is one thing; keeping it is entirely different. And if that is the plan, then I think bad things are going to start happening with greater regularity. Henry, good to talk to you. Thanks for that. Let's see. Norman says, how many times do you think that Trump and Hegseth have, behind closed doors, considered just dropping a nuke on Iran? I bet it's loads, says Norman, and you never know, there might actually be some sensible people in the current administration stopping him. If I had to bet one way or the other, I'd say you're 100% right. I bet they've talked about it a lot. Plymouth, hello, Mark.
Hello, Mark. Oh, hi, Nick. How are you? Yeah, I think the troops going into Iran at the moment are just because of Karg Island. They're going to surround that and take control of the oil. And what worries me about America is it's not just Trump. It's the people around him as well. I think they're just as bad as him.
Well, he selected them.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it's not going to stop with Trump when he decides to, whatever happens to him. But they're looking to send the troops in, control the oil, and it's a bit like Iraq, isn't it, where the troops went in and the country had a meltdown because they couldn't get hospitals, they couldn't get water, anything else, and the Americans were surrounding the oil fields. And that's exactly what's going to happen with Iran. All they're after is looking after the oil. And then what you'll find is the people who supported America in Iran initially will turn against them because things will get worse and it'll be a repeat of Iraq.
I think it won't be a repeat. I think it'll be significantly worse because Iran is such a bigger foe.
It'll be a repeat, as in the outcome, but on a larger scale.
Right.
It'll be no strategy in terms of how you look after the country and get the right people in. I think Trump's such an idiot. He probably thinks he can do some deal with somebody and put them in power and it will be straightforward, but that's what he wants to do, right?
I think that's precisely what the... if they did have any kind of plan, I think that was it. They were going to bomb them into immediate submission, put my close person, maybe Steve Witkoff or Jared, Melania, she might want to do it. They just put somebody, somebody friendly in there, and America can start, ringing tills.
That's what he wants to do. He wants to do that in his little brain. He'd like to have people, in Cuba, in all over the world that he can control, Venezuela with the oil, and work with them and cut a deal. That's Trump through and through, and it's not as simple as that, as we know.
No.
And the problem he's underestimated is the culture of the country. They will fight, and they'll continue to fight, and there's going to be a huge amount of upheaval, I think, in the next... Well, I think, I don't know how long this is going to go on for, but it's going to be very messy.
Yes, well, it doesn't really... It's worse than how long it goes on for, because the consequences of what's already happened are going to reverberate for possibly years. I mean, the infrastructure that has already been damaged or blown up completely... It can't be repaired straight away. It's going to take years for it to be repaired. So be prepared for high fuel prices, at the very least, for a considerable amount of time. It's not just going to snap back to how it was. And with all the other things that, oil is in, like I said before, plastics and medicine and clothing and everything. The whole of the modern world is based on oil. And if you take out if it's only a fifth of the supply a day, then the consequences of that are going to be absolutely immense. Don't we live in interesting times? Tenerife, hello, Colin.
Hello there.
Colin.
Right, I'm talking about this Iran-America war thing. My personal thoughts are the only winners that are going to come out of this will be Russia and China, that between them will rule the world. There's no way in a million years that America will take back the Straits, and how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of troops are they going to send there to try and achieve it? With all the stock that's being stuck where it is, how many millions of people are going to die because of malnutrition, because they can't get everything they need? And I just think that, Trump has so not thought about the consequences of what he's doing, because his ego, the size of the universe, that it's going to destroy the world and just hand it straight to Russia and China.
Well, as much as what Trump does, seems to oddly please Vladimir Putin, I bet President Xi of China wakes up laughing. I mean, everything is going his way. I mean, it's now got to the point that where we used to automatically be on America's side, now China looks like a lot more stable a partner. Thanks, Colin. Maidstone, hello, Lawrence.
Hi, good evening. I just wanted to remind all the callers of past history of Iran. In 1980, Iraq, backed by America and Israel, tried to invade Iran because they thought, oh, well, they're a year into the revolution. They're not strong. They aren't organized. That war lasted 8 years. They lost 500,000 is what they think. Yeah, a lot of people think it was a lot more. They had between 1.2 and 1.3 million casualties. Do you really think Iran's going to back down with deaths in the thousands?
Well, I don't think that. No, I'm not running this. I'm not running this war. Apparently, the person that does imagines that that is a possibility, alarmingly. All right, thank you, Lawrence. Bath, hello, John.
Hi, Nick, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
You know, one of your callers earlier on, a young man, said that he was quite embarrassed by the fact that he invested in oil. I mean, who are these young people that are investing in oil nowadays, given the climate? And given, first of all, that's quite worrying to start with. The other thing I wanted to say is that when are we going to stop this colonial interference? You know, we're about to pay reparations for all the countries we've done this thing to over the last few hundred years. And now we're still going into places like Oman, like Iran, trying to take their oil. like it. Like, oh, they're like children. They can't look after themselves. Let us have it. At some point, we need to stop this.
I think we'll stop it when the human race gets over its instinct for greed.
Yes.
As in, never.
Yeah, well, that's the point, you see. When you realise that, you realise we're all doomed.
And on that positive note, thanks, John. Let's see. Archie says, it's not just Putin. Israel is playing Trump like a fiddle. Well, that's what the that's what Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, he said, that the reason that America is in this war is because they heard that Israel was going, and America feared any attack might blow back on them. So that's why we're here, according to the Americans. David in Woking says, Trump has not succeeded in any business except selling his name. Not most, every single one. 10 years from now, even his name will be mud. I think that I think he's, if that's the schedule, then he's way ahead. Now, thanks for your calls on that. Sorry couldn't get to all of you. Plenty of opportunities to talk about that on LBC to come. But I'm going to take a news break, after which, less than 2 years since securing a landslide victory, the Labour Party is facing electoral wipeout in May's local elections, so we hear. It's set to lose almost 2,000 councillors, throwing the Prime Minister's future into uncertainty at a time when his approval ratings are bad, but improving somewhat because of what we have just been talking about. But how did we get here? Is there anything Keir Starmer can do to avoid this supposed wipeout? And does Labour have a chance at getting your vote in May? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. A leading Iranian official has warned against a US ground invasion, saying its troops would be set on fire. The parliamentary speaker in Tehran says forces are waiting for the arrival of Americans following reports Washington was preparing for the possible deployment of ground troops. But the defense analyst Sean Bell has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC the White House may be trying to call Tehran's bluff.
One of the reasons why America is sent these troops in is because it looks very much like President Trump's looking for an off-ramp. He loves to do a deal, and you've got to have leverage if you're going to do a deal. Well, actually, by at least deploying troops, it looks as if there might be some credibility to his threat to invade, and it might just sow a seed of doubt into the Iranian leadership's mind that he just might do it. That might be why he's doing this whole escapade.
The International Atomic Energy Agency says an Iranian plant used to produce heavy water is no longer operational. Tehran reported it was attacked on Friday and that Israel had claimed responsibility. Israel's prime minister says the country's military has been ordered to expand its operations in the south of Lebanon to combat the threat being posed by the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. It comes after warnings last week it would enlarge a so-called buffer zone up to the Litani River. Ali Risk is a Lebanese journalist and expert on Hezbollah. He's been telling LBC Israel's plan may have some flaws.
Hezbollah, it has long-range missiles. It has missiles which it can launch from the Bekaa area. So I think that even if the Israelis are able to establish a buffer zone, I think that that can only accomplish so much, given that Hezbollah's arsenal still remains quite formidable, as we've been seeing over the past few weeks.
It's been claimed three people have died following a Russian strike on the Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk. Police say a 13-year-old boy was one of the dead, while 13 others have also been injured. A woman has suffered life-threatening injuries after a suspected hit-and-run crash involving a motorbike in central London. It happened around Trafalgar Square on Sunday morning. Police are still looking for the rider of the bike. And in sport, Kimi Antonelli has become the youngest leader of the Formula One World Championship. The 19-year-old Mercedes driver took victory in this morning's Japanese Grand Prix. LBC weather. Clear spells for many parts of England and Wales overnight, but there will be showers continuing across northern England, Scotland and most of Northern Ireland. There'll be a low of around 3 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Labour has been forecast to lose as many as 2,000 councillors in the local elections coming up. Starmer's party faces a wipeout on May the 7th, with more than 3 in 5 of the Labour councillors up for election expected to lose when voters in 136 local authorities go to the polls. This is based on a projection by Professor Stephen Fisher, an elections expert at Oxford University. He suggested that Labour would suffer a net loss of 1,900 councillors. Meanwhile, Reform UK was projected to gain 2,260. Well, let's talk about this with Douglas Beattie. Douglas is author of How Labour Wins and Why It Loses from 1900, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Douglas.
Hi there, Nick. Thank you for having me on. Nice to speak to you.
Appreciate your time. To what extent do you think that Labour's demise is being reported as fact by those who want to will it to happen?
Yeah, I think there is some of that in the media, and there's a lot of polling around, and the polling tends to be to some degree all over the place and to some degree fairly static around where Reform are and where Labour are. But there is certainly a narrative out there that Labour is doomed to fail these coming elections. I mean, postal voting papers are going out now. People will start to do the postal vote shortly, and then we'll get to the real thing on May the 7th. But I suppose Labour strategists would tell you there's a hell of a lot still to play for. That would naturally be what a major political party would say at this juncture.
Yes. To what extent do you think that the war or a non-involvement in it, Keir Starmer's position on that, is going to affect the outcome?
Well, it's hard to tell about the outcome, simply because there is a national picture, as you point to, and there is a local picture. And lots of people will vote to some degree locally, but with national thoughts in mind. And that, yes, is the kind of instability around the conflict or involvement stroke non-involvement around Iran. But also, I think, perhaps in metropolitan areas, in all honesty, the data that I'm picking up from both Labour sources and sources in other parties is that the issue of Gaza, for instance, is still a live issue. So I think we will need to see basically what happens on the day and the night there, and look at how people have voted before we can really second guess.
But the issues that you just mentioned, they're not even national issues, they're international issues, aren't they? So if people are voting based on that, then local issues don't really enter the equation.
Well, I think people will... So if you're a candidate, for instance, at a local election, Nick, I think lots of people will be saying, look at me, I'm your Labour candidate, and we need to be in running the council because we will protect your services. That would be their pitch, right, by and large. But you're right, at the same time, there are these international issues. And people can either decide Keir Starmer is doing a pretty solid job in trying times, vis-a-vis Iran, for instance, or they can say to themselves, well, actually, I'm not very happy with the way this government is running the country. So really what I'm saying to you is, often the national picture bleeds into local elections. We've seen this in the past many times. You know, look across the last decade, both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party lost many, and they have been unpopular nationally, but they've lost councillors in local elections. It happens. Although it has to be said, losing 2,000 councillors would be pretty historic, in all honesty.
Yeah, Keir Starmer's position is said to be in question, depending on the outcome. But if the result isn't as bad for Labour as some are predicting, could it actually be good for him, even if there were large losses?
Yeah, I think if you took the figure of 2,000 and, you know, that became part of what people expected, and it were less bad than that, I think people at the top of the Labour Party would say, well, it's been a bad night, but it's not all that bad. We're 2 years into the Parliament. We face a lot of difficulties on a lot of fronts. Now is not the time for a novice. Actually stick with what we've got. And Keir Starmer has made it perfectly clear, both to friends and to colleagues, that he's no intention of going anywhere. And in fact, as we know, in February, saw off a bid by Anas Sarwar, the leader of Scottish Labour, to have him step aside. That was a very successful operation by the whips in Westminster. So in a sense, Keir Starmer could be strengthened if the results are not as bad as expected. But again, we'll just have to wait and see, because the impression I get is Labour are expecting fairly big losses, in all honesty.
Do you think that Keir Starmer is acting in the interest of the party or in his own interests in sticking around?
Well, I think as he would see it, that, you know, he has been prime minister for less than 2 years. He ran on the mantra on the notion of change. That was up in lights in Labour's manifesto. I think he would say, perhaps understandably, he should be given time. He should be given time to carry this out. Now, I suppose he would argue that's both in his interests and in the interests of the country. And I think what we would have to ask ourselves, what is the alternative? You know, what is the alternative direction? As well as who is the alternative? Who might come in and implement a different set of policies as Labour Prime Minister? Because it simply can't be about the personality. If people want their lives to change, and I think that is the mood of the electorate around things like the cost of living, for instance, and many other things besides, it is not just about getting rid of one person. It's about affecting that change, really.
There's also this, you know, the spectre of war hovering above us. Do you think that that actually might inform people's choices at these elections more than national issues or local issues? And it might come down to perhaps whichever party leader is perceived to be closer to Donald Trump.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not actually convinced that being close to Donald Trump is necessarily a good thing for a party leader right at this moment.
No, I meant it as that would be a bad thing.
Yes, yeah, sorry. But, yes, you're quite right. And I think that's maybe a weakness in Nigel Farage's armour for the moment, because it seems to me that Trump is kind of, you know, in one place one day and in completely the opposite the next. So, again, you can make this argument, really, if you're a Labour strategist, that Keir Starmer is doing a very solid job. These are very difficult times, both economically and politically, and that to change now actually is fraught with great difficulty. And again, to change, I mean, the thing is, Labour has very rarely, Nick, over the years, got rid of a sitting prime minister. They only did it in 2007 when Gordon Brown came in 1976 when Jim Callaghan replaced Harold Wilson. And in both cases, these were men who had huge experience in government. So, you know, who is to come in and have the similar experience in government? There really isn't anyone in the cabinet beyond Ed Miliband and Yvette Cooper. Who, you know, so there are not all that many candidates who could say, well, you know, I could do it, I have the experience to do it, and I will lead you in a different direction.
Do you think part of Keir Starmer's problem is that he followed, I mean, I know that there were a couple of faces in between, but he followed Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson was the biggest beast that has been in number 10 for, you know, at least a decade. And he had such an act. And although the public seemed to be tired of a politician with an act, it was still a bit like, you know, following Ken Dodd on stage with somebody who does card tricks. People might have got tired of the tickling stick, but they might be secretly yearning for a bit of entertainment. And that's the last thing that Keir Starmer is, entertaining.
No, I don't think he would argue with you personally on that point. I think he would probably think that, you know, it's actually his strength has been that he is not Boris Johnson. His strength is that he is a serious politician for serious times. Johnson, yes, had charisma in bucket loads. There's no doubt about that. And it's also true, actually, that when the Conservatives junked Boris Johnson, they soon bitterly regretted it. So I don't know. My assessment of politicians, Nick, is always this: they must show that they're authentic. They can't try and be what they are not. Boris Johnson, it was very easy. He was just being who he was, essentially, and I think Keir Starmer has to be that too. And that is a golden rule for me in politics. The electorate, your listeners, and so on, can smell a mile away politicians that are not that are inauthentic, that are trying to crack jokes and be someone that they're not. It is vital that Keir Starmer is his own man. And he may be more of his own man, actually, now that Morgan McSweeney is not by his side.
You know, much of the talk has been about Keir Starmer's position being at risk, but the Tories are also predicted to lose three quarters of their council seats. Is Kemi Badenoch's position in question, do you think?
Well, I don't think it is. And the principal reason for that, Nick, for saying that, is that I actually don't think the Conservatives are really on the pitch in the way that they have historically been and probably need to be again. So at the moment, Kemi Badenoch is really arguing from a minority position. This is about Labour and reform, but it's more than that, actually. What Labour is concerned about is not so much the Conservatives at any point across the country, by and large, but you have a very fragmented electorate that reminds me a lot of 2015, where you have now populist nationalists in Scotland and the SNP, you have Plaid Cymru in Wales doing well, you have the Greens rising, the Liberal Democrats with a strong base in the south of England, and reform that are across the board an issue for Labour. So I don't think it's so much about the Conservatives as far as Labour are concerned. I think Kemi Badenoch is probably safe to the end of the Parliament, at least. But, you know, the Conservatives are really, as we know, are really not where they have been historically at all.
No, and neither are we, really. I mean, as you just described, now we've got five major parties, not two mm-hmm. anymore. Is the electoral system that we have got, this first past the post, actually working for us anymore?
Well, that is the thing. It's a really good question, Nick, because that is the thing to look out for on the night with reform. If reform get anywhere near 30% on the overall trend polling, you know, of actual voting in these elections, it will tell us whether they can actually be in a position over the next 2.5 years to continue with this polling trend and be in a position to form a government. The system is fractured because people, I think, want change. But we have moved from 2017, for instance, we had two parties basically on 40%, the Conservatives and the Labour Party. And it has changed a lot since then. Is the system still working for us? Yes, I think it is. You could have a party that could win an overall majority, just about, at Westminster, looking at the polling as it is today. Or you might have a coalition of two parties. But we've had coalitions and pacts at many times in the past. 2019, for instance, Theresa May and the Democratic Unionists and the coalition government, the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats. I didn't agree with their policies, but they actually held themselves together for 5 years. And actually a number of times before that in 20th century history. So the system still works by and large, I think. If we get to the position where there are lots of parties on about 17, 18 to 20%, that is a very, very fractured picture and quite a challenge, I think, for the country.
Yeah, can you envisage a situation where reform get the most votes, but reform plus the Conservative vote does not equal the Lib Dems, the Greens and the Labour Party, SNP and Plaid Cymru? Mm-hmm. And so reform might ostensibly win, but lose.
So, yes, what you would have there is a kind of a rainbow coalition proposal, which really is kind of what you would have had in 2010 had Labour gone into office under Gordon Brown, stayed in office under Gordon Brown in 2010. If reform, theoretically, were the biggest party by some distance, they, constitutionally speaking, would have the chance, would have the first opportunity of forming the next government. And that would be, and if Labour were significantly behind that, then no one could really argue with that. So I think the idea of a reform conservative government is certainly not impossible. But there is a clear mood on the left of British politics, understandably, to stop Nigel Farage. So again, the maths on all of this is really crucial. And this is what we'll have to sift through and look for in the coming elections, because it is a signpost towards the next general election.
Yeah, I wonder if because Nigel Farage's signature policy is Brexit. That was a failure by his own measures. None of the promises came true. He's reportedly an almost totally absent MP for Clacton. Reform Council seemed to attract tales of disarray. Could it be possible that winning control of more councils by reform could actually work against reform's chances at the general election, because more people will see them in operation up close?
Yeah, it's an excellent point, because really it's a test bed. The test bed is what do you do once you get power? How do you exercise it? How effective are you at changing people's lives for the better? That's the measure, I think, for any political party, really, whichever side of the fence they sit. So certainly the Reform have had some difficulty with the councils they are running and the councillors they have had to date. Then you have Labour, party in government at Westminster, a party that has been around for many decades and has very deep roots in British society. So it is quite, you could see, and again, this very fractured picture, that if the economy is better, if people feel that, you know, the country is starting to work for them under Labour, and Labour are doing some very good things, nationalising the railways as an ongoing process. They've got the Employment Rights Bill, and they're lifting hundreds of thousands of children out of poverty by getting rid of the two-child benefit cap. Now, if people then see the economy working for them, I think Labour really have a chance, and Reform will have to prove at local level that they can do it. So your point, I think, is a very sound one, actually. Reform are really untested, is the point.
Very good to talk to you, Douglas. Thanks so much for that. That's Douglas Beattie, author of How Labour Wins and Why It Loses from 1900. So what do you think? The demise of the Labour Party in these May elections has been written up by so many papers. It's almost taken as a fact now. But Starmer's popularity has seen something of a turnaround, as in it's got much better since he stood up to Donald Trump and refused to get us, initially at least, involved in this insanity going on in the Middle East. So are Labour likely to lose as many councillors as people say? And fair is not really something that that appears much in politics, but would it actually be a fair judgment of his performance so far, given the catastrophic mess that he inherited from the Conservative Party after they disassembled the country for 14 years straight? 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850, email nicka@lbc.co.uk, and if you are on WhatsApp, then it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10, Nick Abbott, LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
This is a shameful, this is a shambles.
Straight to the point.
How was that allowed to happen?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Show some evidence, Minister.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
The Paramount Plus Spring Sale is on, with over 60% off Paramount Plus. Sign up to stream every episode of exclusive shows like the critically acclaimed hit Landman, brand new series The Madison, starring Michelle Pfeiffer and Kurt Russell, and new Yellowstone series Marshals. All for only $2.99 a month, only on Paramount Plus. But hurry, offer ends Tuesday. Standard monthly plan only for eligible customers. Saving when compared to the full regular monthly price. After 2 months, auto renews at $7.99 a month unless cancelled. 18 plus, T's and C's apply.
It's not easy being a clamp, stuck on the wheel of the one person on the street who didn't tax their car. Yeah, Graham at number 7, I'm talking about you. Bet the neighbourhood group chat is as well. Wish I had a group chat. Maybe I can chat to myself. Hi, Clampy, how's it going? Not great, Clampy. Being clamped to the only untaxed car for miles is so lonely. Over 98% of drivers tax their vehicle on time. Tax it. Don't risk it. Visit gov.uk/DVLA/taxit.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, we're talking about the forthcoming local elections on May the 7th. And I wonder if you believe what the polls are saying, because it seems like an extraordinary wipeout of 2,000 councillors, which has been predicted by some quarters, for the Labour Party. Meanwhile, Reform UK, whose popularity has dipped since last September, are still being projected to gain 2,260 councillors. Now, given the somewhat chaotic scenes at some of the councils that Reform has won, do you think that that's actually an enticing prospect, or should we be somewhat alarmed at that? In fact, should we believe any of these polls at all? Because the polls did say that Reform would win Gorton and Denton. In fact, Reform were sure of it. They had the pink champagne on ice. But that did not come to pass. So perhaps the the stories of the demise of the Labour Party, at least on a local level, have been somewhat overstated. Cambridge, Hassan.
Yeah, hi, Nick. I think I really liked your contributor, but I think Labour is in a very, very difficult position because they are defending nearly half of the 5,000 seats up for local elections, and they're also going to lose big in Wales for the first time. And also, if you look at which seats are up for election, there is a very large, about 1,100 seats in London, which Labour is defending out of 1,800. Mm. And London is a progressive city. They have selected elected Sadiq Khan three times, I think. And so Labour's vote will continue to hemorrhage primarily to the Greens, because that's where a lot of the Muslim vote, a lot of the working class vote, a lot of the youth vote is going. And I think the Greens will do very well. I don't believe Reform will suddenly win 2,000 seats. I mean, there are only 1,300 seats that the Tories are defending. So I'm sure Reform will make serious inroads in that. But because so much of it, of the action is concentrated around London, I think Reform will have a disappointing night, but I think the Greens will do very well.
Yes, I think that is an interesting point that I'm not sure pollsters have actually addressed. I mean, maybe it's maybe it's part of their systems to take this into account, but it seems to me that the polling could be off because, as you say, the areas going to the polls are not indicative of the country at large. They're urban areas in many cases, like London, which do not tend to support Nigel Farage.
Yes, and I think that is, and for anybody who wants to stop Farage, I think the May elections could be very critical, because I think if the Greens can replicate what they did in Gorton and Denton and actually prove that you can beat Labour without risking a Farage victory, I think that takes away the key plank for Keir Starmer. And I think Starmer is going to continue to face incredible pressure from Trump, because his demands will be never ending. And also, if you look at what Tony Blair, etc., have been saying, he is going to feel a lot of internal pressure from the right wing of the Labour Party, which has historically been Starmer's only vote bank. And I think they will pressurize Starmer into sort of acceding to some of Trump's demands, which will become more and more ridiculous.
I think if Keir Starmer looks at the polling since he stood up to Donald Trump, then he would be less inclined to agree to anything Donald Trump says. And as for Tony Blair, I speak for some of us when I say he has perhaps delighted us enough.
Yes, and I think, and that's the key, right? That if you look at the Canadian Prime Minister, the Australian Prime Minister, I think even the Danish Prime Minister, all these parties won those elections by actually standing up to Trump. But Starmer seems to be a much more sort of, I don't think he has the same steel in him to actually...
So far the evidence is that he does have exactly that, and it has paid off for him, and we'll be talking about that in slightly more detail after the news at 10:30, but still taking your calls on this subject. Thanks for that, Hassan. Bournemouth. Hello, Terry.
Hello, Nick. It's very dark where we're going in many, many ways, and I just hope the British public will wake up to realise what the ultimate plan is with Farage and his ilk. They really are going to go for our NHS. And if somewhere along the line, politicians don't really stand up to this move, we are going to be so impoverished. Not only are we going to likely be in a war, but we're going to be suffering the kind of fate that people have in America, where they get bankrupt because they can't afford their medical bills. It's really scaring me.
People don't go to hospital because not only can they not afford the hospital bills, they can't afford the ambulance to take them to the hospital.
No, absolutely. I know people in America, I won't go into too much details, but somebody I know, the brother took his life because he couldn't afford his diabetic medication any longer.
I know people. Yeah, I know people who cut their pills disgusting. In half because the medicine that they've been prescribed by their doctor is too expensive. So I mean that is the last system on earth that we would want to emulate. But there is that famous clip of Nigel Farage. I don't think he realised he was being filmed when he said it. But he said he does think that we should go to an insurance-based system.
Yeah,
he also said that he believes that his money would be better spent on his health if he had control over it rather than put it into a big pot and it was used to the benefit of all, which is saying that we don't need the police. I can just hire my own security guards. That's ridiculous.
That's a very good analogy. You are rather good at analogies, aren't you? it's not a laughable matter. I just wish the people on the centre or to the left would actually get together and stop fighting each other and realise the seriousness of what could be happening over the next few years with...
I wonder if that's exactly what is about to happen, that people are really, in these forthcoming elections, they are really going to start voting tactically in order to perhaps not get what they want, but to avoid getting what they really don't want.
Well, I would vote for that. Yeah. Good idea, Nick.
All right, thanks a lot, Terry. 0345 6060 973. Liz says, Starmer needs to reshuffle the cabinet. No one I have spoken to has any confidence in Rachel Reeves. If she was sacked and replaced with someone who has a better proven track record in economics, he may stand a chance, but he must act before May. Well, I think most people are saying that they need to get May out of the way, or these local elections out of the way, and then see how they are and act accordingly. I think moving the deck chairs around before that doesn't really make much sense. I mean, it could go tremendously well, you know, and the future is not set. It's 11:30. We're going to take more calls about this, whether you think that the Labour Party is on track to lose three quarters of its councillors in the elections that were going to be on May the 7th, or perhaps the right-wing papers that are mostly printing this stuff are just trying to will it to happen. 0345 6060 973, so more of your calls on that to come. Going to take a break for the news, immediately after which, and a related topic, because Starmer's rift with Donald Trump has given him a popularity boost. But will it be enough to secure his survival? That's to come. Just past 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The Prime Minister will gather business leaders in Downing Street tomorrow to address the impact of the Iran war. Sir Keir Starmer is expected to meet senior representatives from the energy, shipping and financial services industries. The International Atomic Energy Agency is saying an Iranian plant used to produce heavy water is no longer operational. Tehran reported it was attacked on Friday and that Israel had claimed responsibility. And a woman suffered life-threatening injuries after a suspected hit-and-run crash involving a motorbike in central London. It happened around Trafalgar Square on Saturday night. LBC weather, clear spells for many parts of England and Wales overnight, while there'll be rain across northern England, Scotland and large parts of Northern Ireland. There'll be a low of around 3 degrees.
This is LBC.
The Paramount Plus spring sale is on, with over 60% off Paramount Plus. Sign up to stream every episode of exclusive shows like the critically acclaimed hit Landman, brand new series The Madison, starring Michelle Pfeiffer and Kurt Russell, and new Yellowstone series Marshals. All for only $2.99 a month, only on Paramount Plus. But hurry, offer ends Tuesday. Standard monthly plan only for eligible customers. Saving when compared to the full regular monthly price. After 2 months, auto renews at $7.99 a month unless cancelled. 18 plus T's and C's apply.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. If you are a landlord and you have existing tenants, you must send them a copy of the government's information sheet by the 31st of May, or risk a fine. Find out more at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Banning Dental Group Clinics.
Modern, comfortable and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling. And the whole world smiles with you.
Banningdental.co.uk.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
New evidence of the popularity of Keir Starmer's decision to stand up to Donald Trump over the Iran war has emerged. The Prime Minister's personal approval rating has increased by 26 points when voters are reminded of his spat with the US president. That is according to a survey for The Independent. And The Independent's chief political commentator is John Rentoul, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, John.
Hello there.
Is this the typical war bounce that a leader gets, except in this case it's that we aren't at war?
Yes, I mean, a sort of anti-war bounce, if you like. I think it's a very interesting poll, this, by JL Partners for the Independent. I mean, they did a split sample. They asked half the sample what they thought of Keir Starmer without any preamble. But the other half, they had a long sort of reminder of recent events. Keir Starmer refusing to allow the Americans to use British bases for anything except defensive purposes, and the fact that he'd had a bit of a run-in with Donald Trump. And then when they asked people what they thought of Keir Starmer, he got a much better rating. I mean, still, we were still in negative territory, but it was better negative than the straight question.
That's a really remarkable thing, isn't it? I mean, how can people have been unaware of what's been on the news on a daily basis for the last month?
I think it's very interesting because it tells you a lot about how polling works, and actually I think it reminds you that you've got to be a bit careful in interpreting polling. Because normally if you ask people a question, you know, what do you think of Keir Starmer? They just do thumbs down. Without any sort of thinking. But I mean, if you remind them of some stuff he's done recently that they might approve of, they're prepared to give him a second look. And I think that sort of captures the way a lot of polling works. A lot of questions can be quite superficial, and people can quite easily give a very different answer if you ask the question differently.
Well, is this the recency effect that people remember what they were told last, and they sort of cling on to this sort of vague notion that they don't like the man until they're reminded of the good things that he has done?
Yes, I think it's the difference between an overall impression and some of the more detailed opinions which you can prod at, and it suggests that there are ways that political parties can campaign, because they can remind people of the things where people actually approve of them and get a better response.
Could the war, once its consequences are really felt, have the opposite effect for Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage, who are both calling for us to do Donald Trump's bidding?
Well, absolutely. And, I think Keir Starmer's been perfectly justified. I mean, Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage absolutely hate it when he brings this up in the Commons. He doesn't answer their questions, and he points out instead that they actually supported the American-Israeli attacks in the first place, which are now having terrible consequences for the world. And in Nigel Farage's case, certainly, he's changed his mind 180 degrees. He now decides that, the war was a bad idea. And they really don't like that being pointed out, but I think Keir Starmer's perfectly within his rights to do so.
Yeah, and Farage and Badenoch have, like you said, they've U-turned since their initial eagerness for us to go into America's war. But do you think the damage has already been done? They will be associated with Trump in the public's mind?
Well, I think Nigel Farage will be anyway, because he's much more of a Trumpy person, and has made a lot of his friendship with Donald Trump in the past. I mean, Kemi Badenoch, I think people don't have such fixed views about her. I mean, it's another example of how public opinion can be shifted. So she's got a chance to recover her her reputation, whereas I think Nigel Farage is in trouble because, I mean, Donald Trump is so unpopular. I mean, he's quite unpopular in America now as a result of this war. But, I mean, and he was unpopular here before, but he's really unpopular now, especially after he insulted our troops in Afghanistan and he was rude to our prime minister. I think there's a lot of people in Britain who didn't have a strong opinion about him and have now turned against him, just like the vast majority.
Do you sense a similarity between Trump's supporters in America and Farage's supporters here?
Yeah, I mean, clearly there's a similar sort of politics. I mean, obviously there's just the anti-immigration issue itself, but there's the style of politics, the pretense of plain speaking, and all the rest of it that Farage gets away with. I mean, I have to say, I think Nigel Farage is rather better at it than Donald Trump, but that's because I'm not an American, I suspect.
Yeah, I was more thinking of the sort of allegiance, the sort of cult-like worship that Trump gets, and Farage seems to enjoy among a certain demographic in this country.
Yeah, it's not quite as sort of ostentatious and vulgar as the Trump phenomenon. You know, there's not quite so much gold decoration around, and you know, Nigel Farage doesn't want to go around putting his name on skyscrapers and institutions in the way that, I mean, Trump's ego is just astonishing. But there is a similarity. I mean, I heard a Nigel Farage speech this week, actually, where he got the crowd going. It was good old fashioned political tub thumping. Much better than Donald Trump, to be honest. But I mean, there is certainly a similarity in the adulation that he gets.
Do you think they peaked? Because last September they were about 33%, and now they're down to about 22 to 25, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, no, they're definitely. I mean, if you look at the averages of the opinion polls, you know, Reformer heading downwards, so much so that Nigel Farage. In Chris Curtis's words, I mean, he's an MP, Labour MP, who used to work for YouGov. He pointed out that Nigel Farage complaining about YouGov's methods is a bit like someone complaining about the tape measure.
Well, that is very Trump, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, Nigel Farage was sort of prancing about declaring that he got some great victory because YouGov were going to publish two sets of figures in future. I mean, to be completely fair to YouGov, they've always been transparent about their methods. When somebody asks them, you know, what do they do differently from other opinion pollsters, they pointed it out. They said what the difference it made to Reform's voting intention. It does reduce it a bit. Nobody really knows whether that's more accurate than the other method that most pollsters use. So YouGov will go on publishing all the figures, and then people can make up their own minds.
Yeah, and as far as averages are concerned, it looks that the opposite is happening for the Conservative Party, doesn't it? How has Kemi Badenoch managed to fashion some small degree of success in the recent times?
Well, it's pretty a small bounce she's had. I mean, she stopped the decline, and there was a bit of a recovery, although I think it's tailed off a bit now, because actually one of the things that's happened most recently, I mean, you need a microscope to see it really on the charts, is that Labour has actually picked up a bit of support at the Tories' expense. But Kemi Badenoch has had a good run. I mean, she's had some very, very good performances at Prime Minister's Questions. I mean, I think she did stumble on her initial support for the strikes on Iran. Apart from that, I think she's done extremely well in holding up Tory support.
How much store do you think the public puts in Prime Minister's Questions? Because people like you and me will talk about it a lot, but I wonder how much the public actually pay attention at all.
Well, not much. They may see the occasional clip. But, I mean, if Kemi Badenoch has a good outing at PMQs, then those short clips will be on social media. And they are quite important in that they cheer up Tory MPs, give them a sense of morale, and that buoys them up, gives them the confidence to do to be more more aggressive in interviews and to sock it to their opponents, Labour and Reform, and so it does have some effect. It feeds through into everything. If Kemi's doing well in PMQ, she'll probably be doing well in other interviews as well, and it raises the sort of morale of the troops.
Yeah, what about the morale of the Labour troops at the moment? Do you think Keir Starmer's sort of steady as she goes approach is working with them, and does it actually change people's opinion of it now that we are faced with a war?
Well, I think that is quite an important shift. It does mean that, you know, a lot of these the stories in the press, some of which I write myself, about, you know, Angela Rayner and Wes Streeting manoeuvring for the leadership, all seem a little bit parochial and sort of small in sort of comparison with the international crisis and the scale of the problems that the country's likely to face over the next few months. So, yes, I think that has damped down a lot of that sort of leadership speculation. I think the other thing is that, you know, Keir Starmer was in trouble when last month, when the extent of Peter Mandelson's association with Jeffrey Epstein became known, and the extent of Keir Starmer's misjudgment in appointing Peter Mandelson to Washington became clear, and there was a lot of talk then about getting rid of the Prime Minister. But people, you know, Labour MPs looked at the alternatives, decided that Angela Rayner was most likely to win a leadership contest, and decided they weren't actually in favour of that.
Well, okay, just on the subject of Mandelson for a moment, though. Am I wrong in thinking when Mandelson was appointed, there was this general feeling abroad that, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, he might be a slithery snake, but he's our slithery snake.
Yes. Well, I'm afraid I wrote something like that. I thought it was a clever appointment. I thought Mandelson was the sort of person who would be able to work his way through the really difficult business of negotiating with the Trump administration and with Trump himself. And to be fair, he did. You know, he did actually secure a reasonable deal for Britain in the chaos of that sort of Trump tariff nonsense. But it was probably not a price that was worth paying. And who knows how Karen Pierce, who was the previous ambassador, would have done in his stead. I mean, she was quite highly regarded by the Trump people as well.
And I wonder if either Badenoch or Farage had been in Keir Starmer's stead, if they had been in number 10, and their initial reaction was, yes, sir, Mr. Trump, sir, how high would you like us to jump? That you don't really get a second chance to not join a war, do you? If Badenoch or Farage had been in number 10, we'd be in this war now, wouldn't we?
Well, it's a fitful war, isn't it? I mean, the US is launching some strikes against Iran some of the time, and so we would take part in those or not take part in them as Nigel Farage as Prime Minister decided. And if he decided the war was a bad idea, we would stop taking part in it. So it's not like it's all or nothing, but it's very embarrassing for him, I think, for him to make such a commitment right at the start and then to have reversed out of it.
Very good to talk to you, John. Thanks so much for that. John Rentoul, Independent's chief political commentator. Now we're going to take a short break, and then your thoughts on that. I mean, do you think that the way in which Keir Starmer has stood up to Donald Trump and refused to do his bidding, it's had an effect on his popularity? Do you think it's going to have an effect on the result in May the 7th, when many of us will go to the polls in these local elections? Because none of the polling so far has been recent enough to take that into account. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
A defenceless defence secretary all at sea over the numbers.
We have 17 frigates and destroyers.
But next week it's issues closer to home with the business of business rates.
We are putting in a number of reliefs for hospitality. We're doing so in a way that is progressive.
And as hospitality firms prepare for rocketing costs in awful April.
It's a particularly challenging time at the moment. It's why the government needs to prioritise supporting this sector.
Is it now last orders for a sector crying out for help?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
It's not easy being a clamp stuck on the wheel of the one person on the street who didn't tax their car. Yeah, Graham at number 7, I'm talking about you. Bet the neighbourhood group chat is as well. Wish I had a group chat. Maybe I can chat to myself. Hi, Clampy. How's it going? Not great, Clampy. Being clamped to the only untaxed car for miles is so lonely. Over 98% of drivers tax their vehicle on time. Tax it. Don't risk it. Visit gov.uk/DVLA/taxit.
JP Morgan Personal Investing gives you the clarity to make more informed decisions on your investments, which is great because right now something else just became crystal clear. Your kid just outgrew the kids menu. Now he's ordering a truffle gnocchi. You consider making a don't gnocchi it till you try it joke, but now's not the time. Now's the time to grow his world, one bite at a time. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
The Paramount Plus spring sale is on with over 60% off Paramount Plus. Sign up to stream every episode of exclusive shows like the critically acclaimed hit Landman, brand new series The Madison starring Michelle Pfeiffer and Kurt Russell, and new Yellowstone series Marshals. All for only $2.99 a month, only on Paramount Plus. But hurry, offer ends Tuesday. Standard monthly plan only for eligible customers. Saving when compared to the full regular monthly price. After 2 months, auto renews at $7.99 a month unless cancelled. 18 plus. T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
We are talking about the oft-reported, or predicted, rather, forecast that the Labour Party is going to lose as many as 2,000 councillors in the local elections on May the 7th. It's predicted that both Labour and the Conservatives are going to lose three-quarters of their council seats. Reform, on the other hand, are projected to gain 2,260. But I don't think that the polling that suggests that has taken into account what has happened since Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu started their excursion in Iran. So what do you think? Is that and Keir Starmer's reaction to that actually going to turn those polling numbers around? South Yardley. Hello, Clive.
Hello there. I live in Birmingham, and we've got local Labour in local government, national Labour in national government. A week ago, they said they were going to talk about the bin strike. A week's gone by. Nothing as whatsoever has happened on the internet anyway. I check it every day, all the time. If these governments and local government, national government keep promising things and never deliver, which is what's happened for years and years now. The roads around here look like they've been bombed by the Luftwaffe overnight. They're that bad. I'm not joking.
I really feel your pain about the roads, but I think it was a particularly bad winter for that. We had
The back of excuses.
It's not an excuse, it's a reason. The reason that the roads are bad, and I'm not excusing anybody anything, but there is a reason for things, and if you understand it, then you can kind of understand why it's difficult to have fixed them all at, up to now, regardless of which party is running your local council. The roads were in a bad state before, but then we had a tremendous amount of rain, so they got sopping wet and all the rain soaked in. And then we had about a week worth of below zero temperatures, during which that water then expanded and the roads just became the worst that I've ever seen them. So, yeah, that's the reason why, Clive.
That is partly true, but some of the roads have been bad for years and years.
Agreed.
Now, the point I'm making is, if normal governments of what we call the centre ground keep promising things, don't deliver, and bring out the bag of excuses, like comes with crime, the bag of excuses why we can't do nothing, then people will turn to extreme parties.
Like?
anybody.
No, like
you know,
parties.
You don't like mentioning about Mr. H from Germany, but he was very popular at one time, and people would turn to anybody. If the middle ground, centre ground, say, vote for us anyway, and then they let them down time and time and time again, which is what's happening.
Yes.
And we're promising Mr. Trump all this money for defending ourselves. God knows where it's coming from. Nobody's got any idea where it's coming from.
Well, we're not promising money to Trump. We're spending the money on our
own defense.
We're promising
money that he would pay, that we will cover, because he's not going to pay it.
No,
and
we can't even run
our own country.
Yeah, that's not what's happening, Clive. We are running our own country, and we're spending money on our own defense. Trump has suggested that we do that, and that's fair enough. I mean, we've been underspending on defense as far as our obligations are concerned for a good long while. But if you're saying that people who are disappointed with being promised nirvana and it has been seldom delivered are likely to go and vote for, let's say, Nigel Farage, well, Nigel Farage, I mean, he ran on the last local elections on cutting council taxes. And then he put the taxes up in every council that they won. His signature policy was Brexit, which has been a complete failure, even on his own measures. And so you can't trust the main parties to come through with their obligations, but then you can't trust the other parties to do that either, because whenever they've achieved power, they've shown that they are they're not worth your trust. So then what? Thanks, Clive. Luton. Hello, John.
Hello, John. Hello.
No, you're John.
Yes. Hello there.
Hello there.
Yes. I'm not sure you've changed the clock in your studio yet, because at 11:26, you said just before the 10:30 news, we'll take this.
Oh, well, well spotted.
Yeah. So they're all as bad as each other, but what happens if we end up with a hung parliament?
Well, then all sorts of things could happen. We might have to go and vote again until we get it right, or the various parties might coalesce into some sort of rainbow.
Right.
What's that?
They're all as bad as each other, really, because they've come out with the fuel today.
What is that noise, John?
Yeah, that's me stood at a roundabout, and it's telling me where to go, but I'm standing still.
Right, good. Glad to hear it.
But, they said with the toilet paper in COVID, the government said, no, we won't run out, so everyone ran out and got toilet paper. Now they said we won't run out of fuel. So everyone's running out to get fuel.
Yes, well, under normal circumstances, we would not have run out of toilet paper, but people went berserk and filled their garages with the stuff. So we were bound to run out.
That's because the government said we won't run out, so everyone went running out to get it. So
right.
They've done the same with fuel. I had to go to 3 fuel stations tonight to get fuel.
Well, I hope that that's just a local issue, John, because I'm running out myself.
Okay.
All right, thanks for that. Chris says, the next local and general elections are going to be an anyone-but contest. I'm terrified of reform gaining control of my council or the country. I lived through the omni-shambles of the Tories from 2010 to 2024, and I have never voted for them. But I would choose even Boris Johnson over Farage. And the thought of reform running my town doesn't bear thinking about. They couldn't manage an inebriating session in an alcohol production facility, says Chris. Ealing. Leonard.
Well, I'm not actually in Ealing tonight. I'm in Foy, Cornwall again, Nick.
That sounds a delight.
Yeah, I do get around. I have to say, I haven't noticed any fuel shortages down here yet.
Very good.
All news to me. But
yes.
With the May elections, well, I think that they're going to get a real bashing, to be honest. I think that people really can't stand Starmer, and it's good riddance.
But people seem to be coming around. I mean, his popularity has had a surge since he had the nerve to stand up to Donald Trump, and there aren't many leaders in the world who have shown the mettle to do that.
Well, you know, people are very fickle and volatile in this country and pretty stupid as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I've just come back from the United States and absolutely nobody mentioned Trump there all the time I was there. Not one person.
Nobody in America mentioned Donald Trump.
Not once. Never heard anything about politics, never saw any of those stupid newspapers, never saw it on the TV. Well, I didn't watch the TV, so that, I suppose, had something to do with it. But, you know, I just never heard anybody talk about politics.
Were you in a sensory deprivation tank?
No, I was in Chicago, and I was in Michigan, and I was in various other places. So, I mean, you know, I just don't think they're as preoccupied as they are here with Trump.
Well, in the absence of any corroborating information, I'm going to go ahead and not believe you, Leonard. But thanks for that. This message says, if Starmer et al. Wanted to make a meaningful comeback in the next 6 weeks, he'd commit Labour to rejoining the European Union. It would mean adopting EU currency, but not necessarily. But I think even this biggie would detract from the popularity for the majority of the population. This, added to his Love Actually moments, would give him a distinct advantage. I don't know what that means. He might have to join forces with the similar-minded smaller parties in some areas. Yes, well, I think that is an entirely believable possibility, that the Labour Party will join with, let's say, the Greens and the Liberal Democrats, Plaid Cymru and maybe the SNPs, to form a rainbow coalition. Because if you add them up, it doesn't matter which poll you look at, the centre-left parties are more popular than the centre-right ones. So that could be in our future. What is immediately in our future is a break for the news, after which we are going to talk about some comments made by the new Pope, Pope Leo, the first American Pope. The religious leader said Jesus rejects the prayers of world leaders who start wars, accusing them of having hands full of blood. Who can he be talking about? We're also going to check in with our US correspondent before 1 o'clock this evening. And plenty else besides. 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. Sir Keir Starmer will gather business leaders in Downing Street later on today to address the impact of the Iran war. The Prime Minister is expected to meet senior representatives from the energy, shipping and financial services industries. LBC's Jonathan Ray has more.
Today's meeting will take place amid warnings the UK could suffer serious economic damage as a result of the conflict. Discussions are expected to focus on Iran's ongoing blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, which has disrupted ships carrying oil, gas and fertiliser. The meeting will also hear an update on the situation in the region from the UK's Maritime Operations Commander. Downing Street says it wants to hear directly from businesses and discuss how the government and private sector can respond to the conflict together.
The government's Middle East minister has urged Israel to think again about plans to widen its invasion of Lebanon. Writing online, Hamish Falconer says he's deeply concerned by the move. Benjamin Netanyahu says a so-called buffer zone in the country must be expanded to give more protection from the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. Data from one of the UK's leading banks is suggesting Britain's rush to buy petrol and diesel during the immediate aftermath of the start of the Iran war. Barclays is also claiming spending on holidays has fallen dramatically because of the uncertainty being created. A man is still being questioned after seven people were seriously injured in Derby when a car drove into pedestrians. It happened on Friargate on Saturday night and involved a black Suzuki Swift. LBC's Midlands reporter is George Ike.
A man in his his 30s, who's originally from India but living in Derby, was found a short time after the incident. He's been arrested on suspicion of attempted murder, causing serious injury through dangerous driving, inflicting grievous bodily harm with intent, and dangerous driving. Detectives are also being supported by counter-terror officers, but say this doesn't necessarily mean it's terror-related.
Officials in the south of Russia are saying a Ukrainian drone attack has killed one person. They're also accusing Kyiv of damaging homes and industry in the city of Targarok. And it's being claimed three-quarters of Premier League fans are against the use of VAR. The Football Supporters Association has been speaking to nearly 8,000 people. LBC weather, clear spells for many areas of England and Wales overnight, but showers will continue across northern England, Scotland and much of Northern Ireland. There'll be a low of around 3 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Pope Leo has delivered what is described as an unusually forceful message on Sunday, stating that God rejects the prayers of leaders who initiate wars and possesses hands full of blood as the conflict in Iran has entered its second month. Let's talk about this with Caroline Farrow. Caroline is a Catholic writer and commentator and joins us on the line now. Hello, Caroline.
Hello there. Good evening.
What do you make of this address from the Pope?
It's unusually strong rhetoric from Pope Leo. And although he doesn't explicitly mention the US-Iran or US-Israel-Iran conflict, it's very clear that that's what he's talking about. And, you know, I know there's been a lot of criticism. People have said, well, the Pope shouldn't be speaking about this. But actually, it absolutely is part of the Pope's role to speak about these matters, because Catholicism and Christianity, it doesn't just separate faith from moral life or public life. And the Pope isn't just a private spiritual guru. So with that in mind, I think as well, it's unusual because this is the first American, Pope. And as you know, he quoted Isaiah 1:15 and said, God does not listen to the prayers of those who wage war. And he invoked the warning about hands full of blood. And I think it's a very timely moment for this kind of intervention. It's Palm Sunday, and as Christians celebrate Christ entering Jerusalem, not as a warlord, but as a suffering king, the Prince of Peace. So the Pope is very much drawing a line between Christianity and any attempt to dress up violence as this sort of holy crusade. And I think this is in direct, as I said, Pope Leo is the first American pope, and I think this is in direct contrast with a particularly muscular style of public Christianity that's coming from parts of the American right. So recent reporting says that US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has repeatedly used this very overtly Christian rhetoric when talking about the Iran war, and he's quoted Psalm 144 and "He who trains my hands for war," and he's also long defended this crusader imagery. And he's also reported as describing himself as a man of faith who wants troops to lean into faith. And so I think we're looking at that sort of very muscular Christianity, the way that it's being portrayed in the White House as the backdrop to this much stronger than expected language. And I think what the Pope is saying is that Christianity isn't a branding exercise for military power, and God isn't a mascot for geopolitical violence. And I don't think that's anti-American. If anything, it's just like a deeply Christian correction.
Yes. To what extent do you think that people like Trump and Hegseth and that type use religion as a weapon?
Well, I find it, personally speaking, I don't know whether or not Trump uses religion as a weapon, but I'll be honest, I am quite sceptical of Trump's as a Christian leader. I think, who are we going to look to when we're looking for Christian leadership? We as Catholics, you know, I'm certainly a Catholic, we look to the Pope and we look to Christian leaders. So whether or not Trump is weaponizing Christianity. I think he may be in the context of this particular conflict. And I think we just need to be a little bit careful. And some of the Crusader rhetoric is a little bit alarming, because actually the Crusades were quite complex. They're more complex than they're made out to be. We tend to think of them, I say modern thinking, but people think that the Crusades were simply about getting Muslims or Islam out of Jerusalem. But actually there were many, many more complex factors, such as, for example, the Crusaders were looking to protect important trade routes. And also it was a chance to heal the schism between the East and the Western Church. So there's lots of complex factors around the Crusades. And I think the Pope is being very aware of the fact that there are many, many Christian communities around the world, and particularly in the Middle East, and particularly in the Holy Land, who are, you know, facing persecution and are really suffering and are being driven out. So I think he's very conscious to protect those communities as well, by trying to sort of step away from this imagery of it being a holy war, and saying, hang on a minute. Now, I think one important thing to remember is that as Christians, we don't say that war can never, ever be justified, because sometimes it can. There is such a thing as a just war theory, which means, you know, when the consequences are going to be so, so terrible if you don't do something, then you have to go in and intervene. But we don't believe that any war can be made just by sort of wrapping it up in religious language. You know, there has to be a really, really strong justification, and that, you know, it isn't a blank check for war. You know, the burden of proof is really high. So I think the Pope's just reminding everyone that we shouldn't sort of slide too easily into this assumption that there's always like a ready-made moral justification for military action. So, you know, I mean, it's challenging. It is challenging, I have to admit. When I heard his words, I was challenged, because, you know, I'll admit I don't have a lot of sympathy for the Iranian regime. I think most people don't. But does that actually justify steaming in and going to war before all other means of solving the conflict and negotiation have been explored? So, I think we should listen to what the Pope says, and I think, you know, we should think seriously about it, we should allow it to challenge us.
And what do you make of Trump, and particularly the people that he surrounds himself with, this performative prayer and the very visible wearing of the cross around the neck? Is it too much to suggest that they're actually, if not using religion as a weapon, they are using it as a defense mechanism against accusations of doing evil?
Potentially. I think it's more about trying to persuade everyone that it's a holy war. I mean, I was thinking about this earlier, and I was reminded of the First World War. And you had chaplains on both sides, you know, blessing the soldiers, blessing the troops in what was an absolutely horrific and horrendous and futile conflict, saying, you know, you're doing holy work and you're doing God's work. You know, God, you're doing holy work, you're doing God's work. So, I'm very conflicted, because as a Christian, yes, it's wonderful to see, Christian imagery and Christian iconography, and to see professions of faith, but that has to be followed up by, it's not just about what you say, it's about your actions. And can we be 100% sure that what's going on in Iran is 100% just, and, you know, there was absolutely no other choice than to do what they've done? I think most of us are probably quite sceptical and a little bit wary. So, and Trump, you know, let's be honest, Trump certainly... let's be honest, Trump's not my cup of tea. And Trump's past actions don't seem to indicate that he's a man of any deep Christian faith.
And yet he insists that he is. I mean, this is a quote from him. He said, "No one has done more for Christianity and religion of all kinds than me."
Well, that's just narcissism, isn't it? To be honest, that's an outrageous thing to say, and that's certainly not a sentiment that I would agree with. And actually, when you point to some of the things, some of the laws that he has enacted, some of the federal laws that he's enacted and talked about enacting in the US, then they've certainly made Catholics pretty uncomfortable. So.
is the performative nature of their worship actually a defence against suggestions of that kind? I'm thinking about the pictures of, you know, a dozen or so people laying hands on Donald Trump as he sits at the Resolute desk and praising God for giving us Donald Trump, who has been delivered by Jesus to save America, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean that's quite clearly ludicrous, isn't it? It's clearly ludicrous, and I'm just staggered, actually. I mean, to be honest with you, I'm probably I'm one of these very unusual people in that I don't have strong feelings either particularly for President Trump or particularly against him, so I try and avoid too much coverage. So as you're telling me this, I'm quite stunned to hear it. But yes, I do think that Trump is trying to use Christianity to rebuild an image for himself Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm just taken aback, really. I think that Trump is using Christianity to build an image around himself and to portray himself as a righteous Christian leader. And I think the proof of the pudding is in the eating. I'm certainly sceptical of Trump proclaiming himself, and we should be. I'm skeptical of anyone proclaiming themselves to be a great Christian savior or a great Christian leader. The person that we should be relying on is Jesus Christ himself, not someone who claims that he's acting in his name. And certainly when, as I said, if you look at a just war theory and you look at Catholic teaching on war, then the Pope is entirely and 100% right.
Do you think that Christianity, it's not even evangelical Christianity, it's a particular sort of MAGA American Trump fan type Christianity that seems to have taken a left turn, or a right turn actually more accurately, and is almost turned into a cult. It has all the hallmarks of a cult and doesn't really have anything to do with Christianity at all now.
Yeah, I wouldn't so much say a cult, because I've got a very strict understanding of what a cult is. You know, I don't think you could compare MAGA Christianity necessarily to, say, something like Scientology. But I think it certainly has become a particular political ideology. Rather than, you know, Christianity is all about faith in Jesus Christ and in God the Father, Son and Holy Spirit. And you know, we're all taught to think very carefully about who we place our votes for, and to place not our faith in the powers and principalities, but in the spiritual realm, in God and in Jesus Christ. So I think Christianity generally is being weaponized and slightly hijacked by MAGAism and Trump. And actually, they have to look at the principles of Christianity and the faith and morals, rather than just kind of use it as an excuse to whitewash whatever it is that they want to do. But as I said previously, certainly a lot of President Trump's actions, you know, haven't pleased very many Catholics, because they haven't been in accordance with Catholic teaching. And, you know, we have an American Pope. So, you know, I would say that the American Pope, Pope Leo, or Robert Prevost, as was, He's much, I would say, he's the American that we should be listening to on this.
Yeah, but is it possible that you can have two sides of an argument? One on Donald Trump's side, who has already clashed with this Pope. I can't remember the exact nature of the disagreement, but I think Trump said something to the order of, he's very disappointed with this new Pope. Is it, can you have both sides of an argument, one side the Pope and the other side Donald Trump, who claims that no one has done more for religion than him? Can both sides have an argument that is equally valid, or as a Christian, do you have to pick one?
Well, I think what we have to remember is, you know, we have to be true to Jesus Christ, you know, we have to follow the teachings of our faith. And I think if you're asking yourself, if you're certainly asking me as a Catholic, who do I listen to? The Pope, the holy, you know, very holy and learned man who's the successor of Peter, or Donald Trump? Then it's no real question.
Yeah.
You know, and it is interesting actually. I think I was just pondering on your, you know, can MAGA Christianity become cult-like? I think it can become, it is quite idolatrous, actually. I think MAGA Christianity can become an idolatrous distortion of Christianity when Christ is subordinated to a political movement. I think that it's quite interesting, isn't it? We've got ordinary Christians who vote Republican. You've got Christians with conservative political views, and then you've got a more extreme tendency that seems to sort of sacralise Trump or American power. And I think it can become cult-like. Christianity can become cult-like when political loyalty eclipses Christian truth. And when we start treating a leader as beyond criticism, or we turn our faith into a tribal badge for power, that's when we're in trouble, and that's what we have to be aware of. And as I said, if you're asking me to pick sides between the Pope, the successor of Christ, and Donald Trump, and who I'm going to listen to, of course, I'm going to listen to Pope Leo and take his direction. And I think all Christians automatically should.
Caroline, very good to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time. Sorry. That's the Catholic writer and commentator, Caroline Farrow. So where are you on this? Because Donald Trump and the new Pope, Pope Leo, have clashed. Well, the clash was really from Donald Trump to the Pope, not the other way around. But they are not really on the same page as far as religion is concerned. Who do you think is more likely to be in God's good books? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
This time last year, Hassan was working in sales and spent his evenings gaming. Now he's working as a prison officer.
You know what's going to happen? It's not worth it. Let's just go in there.
He's tackled cell fires, got through to some of the most challenging prisoners, and helped support their rehabilitation. He's done things he once thought he was never capable of, but he still loves his gaming. An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
Spire Healthcare gave me my life back.
I couldn't speak highly enough for them.
At Spire Healthcare, you can see a leading medical expert privately in as little as 48 hours, so you can get back to what you love sooner.
Spire Healthcare have given me a whole new lease of life.
The care I received was incredible.
And now I feel unbreakable again.
The sooner you're better, the better. Search Spire Healthcare today.
Apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So we haven't heard Donald Trump's response to this, but I think we can predict what he's going to say, or the kind of thing that he's going to say. Because Pope Leo XIV yesterday rejected claims that God justifies war. This was during a Palm Sunday Mass before tens of thousands of people in St. Peter's Square. With the US-Israeli war on Iran entering its second month and Russia's ongoing campaign in Ukraine, Pope Leo dedicated his Palm Sunday homily to insist that God is the King of Peace, who rejects violence and comforts those who are oppressed, which seems to be, to my eyes, the exact opposite of what Donald Trump is saying and doing. 0345-6060-973. Where are you on this? Tavistock. Hello, Rose.
Oh, hello, Nick. Yes, well, so much for the Prince of Peace and love thine enemy. Yes, I think the Pope did absolutely right. And I think he's partly responding to the evident delight that Trump and others are showing in bloodshed. You know, like the shit they blew up when there was another option. Mm. It's more fun to sink them, ha, ha, ha. But I have an idea, Nick, that's entirely my own, so, that this strain of belligerence and unashamedly the extreme right-wing exclusionist white supremacist ideology, which is what these people are all about, who call themselves Christian nationalists, it's claiming the religion in order to incorporate it. So to assume the religion into itself with the idea or the aim thereby of obliterating the actual message. Messages, I should say. I mean, there are many messages, aren't there? Of selfless love and honour, humility and tolerance.
Hmm.
You know, in a similar way to, in the last 80 years, commercial corporations have swallowed up smaller businesses and incorporated what was distinctive into themselves so that these qualities disappear. And it's a sort of pattern. But you see,
kind of like a reverse takeover. A smaller entity takes over the larger one. So how did you describe them? The evangelicals? Is that?
Christian nationalists.
Christian nationalists,
yes.
Right. They are sort of subsuming the wider Christian religion to them, to their own ends, essentially, to use it, as
yes.
I said before, as a weapon and a defence shield against accusations of hypocrisy, perhaps.
Yes, yes, and more than that, to make it disappear, so that what they're saying is this is Christianity and all the real Christianity is disappearing from what they're saying. But, you know, if they get more and more followers, you see, I feel that this, I've put Christian in brackets because what they are is nationalists, extreme right nationalists. They have illusions of spreading this violent and discriminatory nationalistic anti-softness ideology further. So if they could swallow up its opposite, which is the Christian world embracing creed of love, that can only be advantageous. You know, they would have, in a sense, debilitated their main rival. Because what they're doing is trying to subsume their main rival, which is the Christian ideal, into themselves, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I think that if Jesus
rename
did... Yes, if Jesus did come to walk among us, he would, at the very least, be yelled at as a woke lefty.
Precisely.
And probably be locked up as an enemy of the state.
Yes, yes. I mean, I can't think they can succeed in this, really, because the Christian values are held by so many people who don't necessarily call themselves particularly Christian, aren't they?
Should we be sceptical of someone who wears overt symbols of their religion and yet acts in a way that appears to be the opposite of what their religious leader would have suggested is a good way to lead your life?
Well, we should totally, but I think this is their aim, is to say this is what Christianity is. You know, take no notice of the Bible or anything. Mm. This is it. And I mean, you know, you've got the internet. You've got these mad people who will follow all this. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
They're refashioning.
Right.
You seize the thing and refashion it to be you.
Right, more in their own image rather than God's.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Good talking to you. Yeah, good talking to you, Rose. Thanks for that. North Carolina. Hello, Greg.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I shouldn't say that. Everybody says it.
Yeah.
I was talking to your colleague, and the essence of what I had to say, I was at the No Kings yesterday locally.
Oh, yeah.
You got in Western North Carolina, Transylvania. We have about 33,000 people in the county. I imagine we didn't hit 1,000, but we had, you know, the demographic here is a lot of damn Yankees that have moved down to retire, so it's not demographically typical of the county.
Hmm.
But the point of the call is that Caroline Farrow that you were speaking to is perfectly on course or on side in terms of, you know, the Pope's righteous comment on what's going on. But what she's missing the point with you know, the electorate here, certainly in many parts of the U.S. and certainly here, is that everybody is nonconformist. You know, the Baptists hold sway. So we have a church around here called the Anchor Baptist. They have radio stations, media, everything else, and they basically dictate who gets voted in Transylvania County, and have done for many years. So, you know, this is what you're really up against.
Well, are they? You're suggesting that they're a more extreme kind of religion that somebody who is not familiar with, you know, religious teachings would recognise as being Christian.
Yeah, well, I don't think they go out and eat their own children and things of that nature. But the fact of the matter is, you know, people they show up Sunday after Sunday, and it's preaching. So it's as much a theocracy is what they're accusing the Iranians.
Right. Yes, it does seem to be. It's almost as though we're on the cusp of a war between two extremist religions. The one that's sort of within the regime of Iran, and ditto America.
Yes, agreed. And one quick thing before you throw me off is, you know, at this No Kings, I was listening earlier to your broadcast about the, let's call it the unity or the uniformity of the London or the UK demonstrations yesterday. Although the No Kings US program is very worthwhile, there's still no real focus. You know, you're talking to a lot of people that have a smorgasbord of issues.
Yes.
Whether it's ice, whether it's, you know, knocking down the forest,
right,
or oil, or whatever. And at some point, you know, there has to be a focus, because otherwise, you know, this is going to go on and on.
Yeah. Well, that's the job of a political leader, isn't it? To focus a lot of disparate desires among the people into a few sort of easily digestible points. We'll be talking about the No Kings protests a little bit later on. We'll check in with our US correspondent. But thanks for that, Greg. See if I can fit one more in. Birmingham. Hello, Lucy.
Hello.
Lucy.
I won't be as eloquent as your previous callers, but I want to say a few of us are praying for peace in this conflict. And I want to thank publicly on air Pakistan for stepping in and acting as negotiator with this. And I hope they're very successful. It's the only way forward.
Yes, okay, I'll leave you the last word on that. Thank you so much, Lucy. As I said before, we're going to check in with a US correspondent before the news at 1 o'clock. But just after this news break, let's talk about the addictive nature of social media, because these big tech companies lost a couple of cases in America just recently, and Keir Starmer is minded to do something about the addictive nature, particularly as it pertains to children. So I'll be talking to a psychologist about that after this news update with Tim Daly.
The Prime Minister is expected to meet senior representatives from the energy, shipping and financial services industries later to discuss the war in Iran. They're due to gather at Downing Street. Data from one of the UK's leading banks is suggesting Britain's rush to buy petrol and diesel during the immediate aftermath of the start of the Iran war. Barclays also claims spending on holidays has fallen dramatically because of uncertainty. And it's being claimed three quarters of Premier League fans are against the use of VAR. The Football Supporters Association has been talking to nearly 8,000 people. LBC weather, clear spells for many parts of England and Wales tonight, but showers for Northern England, Scotland and Northern Ireland will see a low of around 3 degrees.
Hear every side of the story. This is LBC.
This is 40-year-old Kathy, mother of two and self-confessed telly addict.
Oh, look at you. That's brilliant. Well done.
This is also Kathy, working as part of a team to keep things calm at her local prison.
Come on!
and helping someone's son write his first letter home in 8 months.
Well done. You should be really proud.
Thank you, miss.
An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
Fancy a trip to France without the fancy price tag? Go all Irish. With great low prices, travel from Dover to Calais with Irish ferries and you'll have France at your feet in 90 minutes. Can-can. Less. More money, less money. You get the picture. Get a warm Irish welcome on board and a cool pint of the black stuff on us. Zero alcohol, of course, when you book direct at irishferries.com. Escargot on, then. Irish Ferries. See travel differently. T's and C's apply.
Rin.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Keir Starmer has backed banning addictive social media features in his strongest intervention yet on curbs that could be placed on tech companies. Keir Starmer says that these features should not be permitted. Let's talk about this with Claire Ferniehove. Claire is a psychologist and behaviour change expert who is founder of Generation Focus, a group campaigning to keep smartphones out of schools. And she joins us on the line now. Hello, Claire.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. What do you think? Is trying to ban addictive algorithms rather than the social media sites themselves something that could work?
I think it's a really interesting idea. I mean, I think we're never going to be able to ban the social media sites per se. So I think, you know, the lawsuits we've seen this week, particularly the one in Los Angeles, which was all about addictive design, are really interesting because actually, yeah, we're now showing we can hold companies to account for the way these things are designed. And this is the first time this has ever happened. And, you know, I think it's a really, really good thing because we all know what it's like, that you know, infinite scroll, that autoplay, those features that are so hard to kind of withstand. So yeah, I think we absolutely need to be doing that. But I also think for children, there's a different, you know, this is completely different. We need to be raising the age of social media until at least 16, because regardless of whatever they do to change these platforms, they, you know, children just should not be using these platforms at all. Their brains are just not, you know, sort of developed enough to withstand this technology. So yeah, I think it's great to change the design, but we also need to be raising the age at the same time.
It's something that Australia has done. Do we know anything about the success or otherwise of that experiment?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, it, you know, it hasn't been going for very long, so I think it's wrong to draw any conclusions on it. You know, we hear differing reports, don't we? You know, some children are saying that they didn't have their social media platforms shut down. Others did, and, you know, it's had a good effect on them. So I think it's hard to say yet how it's going to turn out. But what we do know is that countries across the world are really taking note and are doing the same thing. You know, social media is being banned in lots and lots of different countries. And in the UK, obviously, we're consulting on that at the moment. That's what the government's thinking about. So, you know, I mean, Australia led the way. And we're, as campaigners, we're very grateful to them for doing that.
Yeah, the ban is for 16s and under, which it seems a little odd. I mean, there is no developmental cliff edge over the age of 16, is there? A 16-and-a-half-year-old is just the same child mentally as a 16-year-old.
Well, I mean, not exactly, in that, you know, the brain is developing so quickly that actually 6 months at that age does make a difference. But, you know, with all of these things, any sort of ban, you have to draw the line somewhere, don't you, as we do with alcohol. So it's not that an 18-year-old is going to be any less damaged by drinking a bottle of vodka, but you just, you know, with any law, you have to have a rule. 16 does seem like a good line to have. You know, we know that by that time they do have a little bit more maturity. But I think the elephant in the room that we all need to think about is that we are all really addicted to these devices and these platforms. And even if you're 30, you're sort of still susceptible, which is why I think thinking about the design of these platforms is really important, because, you know, we've also got all of these adults in this country who are completely addicted, myself included. So, you know, I think it's an interesting one, but I think 16 does feel about right.
We're talking about fighting the richest people in the world who are backed up by a man that they have donated vast sums of money to, the most powerful man in the world who has their corner. It seems like a fight that can't possibly be won, or is that just too depressing a thought?
I think until this week I might have agreed with you, but I really think this week was a turning point. It's the first time that a court of law has found that there was malice in the way these platforms are being designed, and they were leading to a child being addicted, and this is a test case. And I think we are going to see a tidal wave of, you know, similar lawsuits coming out. And, you know, like we have done in the past, you know, things like tobacco, it's often when things get into the law court, that's when things really change. That said, the business model of these companies will always be to maximise engagement. Whatever they say, that is what they're doing, and they're doing it to make money. And that's why that our campaign, Generation Focus, we're about getting smartphones out of children's hands. Because, you know, we can have as many arguments as we like with these companies, and they wring their hands and they say, oh, we're doing our best, all the while children are being really harmed. The simplest thing to do is to delay giving your child a smartphone, I would say at least until 16, and then we don't need to have this argument anymore because they can't get to any of those platforms. And I think that's much simpler. And that's why we want to get them out of schools and we want to get them out of children's hands.
You could also say that there are there's something else, that this business model is to maximise engagement, to make it so that you are either angry or fearful, that you never put the you don't take your eyes off the site, and it has an endless scroll. It just never ends, and those are news sites. So would you put them in the same category?
Well, I've certainly found myself, you know, getting addicted to news sites and spending too much time on them, but I would say probably not, although I think we do need to think about, you know, how the endless scroll works. You know, the person who invented it, Asa Raskin, is now, you know, a whistleblower for the industry and realised very quickly what he'd done and realised this is a terrible design. But, you know, the thing is about watching, looking at news is you're not looking at self-harm, you know, suicide ideation, you know, violence, misogyny. You're not looking at all of those things. So, you know, we need to think about, you know, what is the content that you are consuming? What's the content that children are consuming? You know, if the worst thing that happened is that we all got addicted to BBC News, we'd be in a better, or, you know, any news channel, we'd be in a much better position than we are now.
But just to push back slightly, I would say that news sites do propose an unrealistic ideal of beauty, of behaviour, and they also push people into making life decisions, voting for political parties, that are not in their interests.
Do they? I mean, I think it depends on what sites you're looking at. You know, the sites I look at, I think they don't do that. But the problem is now there's such a blurred boundary, isn't there, between, you know, kind of a respected news site and, you know, where lots of the younger people now are getting their news from is social media, is, you know, all of these different platforms. And I think, then those platforms are less probably regulated and maybe having a negative impact. But, you know, I think we all need to think about the content that we're consuming, really, and how it's making us feel. But, you know, there's an argument for still having very good journalism and good news websites that we can all trust, I think.
Just how a ban might function. Kids know more about how computers work than their parents. If their parents said that you can have a phone because we want to get in touch with you and make sure you're safe, but we'd prefer that you didn't look at social media, or in fact we're going to make some attempt at banning it from being able to be accessed from your phone. Kids know how to get around that sort of stuff, don't they?
They absolutely do, and they will. And, you know, no ban is going to be absolutely perfect in any way. There will be children who get around it. But this is about resetting the default. This is about changing. You know, we've sleptwalked into a situation that we all know is wrong now. We hear on a daily basis from, you know, medical professionals who are talking about the harms that are happening to these kids. You know, so we've sleptwalked into that, and we need to do something. So, yes, some kids will get around it, but the vast majority of children will be much more protected than they are right now. Because at the moment, it's a complete Wild West. We know that despite the Online Safety Act, these platforms are still feeding children really, really horrific content. So we have to do something. You know, a ban's not going to be perfect. It'll be a lot better than what we have now. And we have a moral responsibility. And I think this is now what, you know, what Keir Starmer's essentially saying, the government is saying, you know, we need to be doing something.
Yes, we need to be doing something about content that is, you know, appalling, like you suggested. But that's not what this argument really is about. It's about the addictive nature of, you know, TikTok or whatever it is that the kids are looking at these days, which is full of people doing silly dances and, you know, folding T-shirts in 1 second flat and all that stuff that's on there. And so asking a company to change its business model by making it less addictive, you'd get quite quickly to the position where lawyers are debating, well, what's the difference between interesting and addictive?
Yeah, absolutely. And we know now that some of these, you know, the features, you know, the endless scroll, the autoplay, it's about there's no friction. There's nothing that stops us. And if we know that if they stop the infinite scroll straight away, you have a massive drop in engagement and you just get a little bit more friction and we get back our agency. You know, we know quite a lot about how that works. Now, the reason we know that's because it was designed with psychologists. You know, psychologists designed these platforms and these designs. You know, same with variable rewards. We know that if we don't know what we're going to get when we check. It's like a slot machine. That's a very, you know, we understand how that works. So we can now isolate these features and say, well, look, we're going to choose to not have those on those platforms. And it may well be that that's actually what these companies have to do. And, you know, yes, they may have to really argue about this in a court of law, but that would be a wonderful thing, I think, for everybody if we weren't all so glued to our phones. Because, you know, it's bad enough for us, but childhood is very, very short. Once it's gone, it's gone. You know, and there's the children who get completely addicted, and then there's lots of kids who just, you know, those little micro interactions between their parents and them and their friends just are being lost because they're all just wanting to go back to their phones. I think that's a bit of a tragedy. And, you know, I think we have to do something about those design features.
Do you think the actual language that we're using is posing problems for some people? Because just the word addiction, and people think cocaine or alcohol, tobacco, something like that, is physically addictive. But we're not talking about that, are we? We're talking about something that is mentally stimulating to the point that it is difficult to put it down. Are the two related?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting one. I think probably technically, some experts would say it isn't classed as addiction. You know, the way it works is we get this flood of dopamine in our brains when we check our phones. It feels great. And then we get a slump afterwards and we need to get more of that dopamine. So we get trapped in a sort of a cycle. And what it means is that the other stuff isn't so interesting. So for kids, you know, reading books, writing, running around outside, none of that seems so interesting. There was a government report that came out 2 years ago that found that 25% of children are showing signs of behavioral addiction to their smartphones. So you can argue about the definition, but the result is the same, really, that kids cannot put these things down. And I think, you know, if you talk to teachers who say, I confiscated a phone from a 15-year-old girl, for example, the impact that it had on her, the like unbelievable breakdown that these children are having when they have their phones taken away, in a way it doesn't really matter what we call it, that is having a huge impact on their lives. And it, you know, they don't want to get away from their phones. So I would argue that is, you know, we could, you know, might as well call that addiction.
Have educationalists determined whether it is affecting people's young people's attention span?
Yeah, anecdotally, absolutely. I mean, there are several psychological studies that show that simply having a smartphone near you, in your vicinity, reduces your cognitive capacity, your ability to focus, your ability to think. So yes, absolutely. And we're now seeing many, many more schools going to much stricter policies because what they have the no see, no hear policy, which means you're allowed it in your bag. It simply doesn't work because they've just got that phone there. They know it's there. And it's just that little itch in your brain where you want to be able to check, which really, you know, stops you from learning and focusing. So yeah, absolutely. You only have to talk to pretty much any teacher who, you know, has a class of kids to say, yes, it really impacts our ability to focus. And that's why one of the things we're campaigning for is a complete ban on smartphones so that schools just say, look, just bring a brick phone. That's all you need. A brick phone does not have any of these features. It's call and text. That's all you need. That's what phones are meant to be. Because let's be honest, smartphones aren't phones, they're supercomputers. We're literally giving children supercomputers, have them in your bag, and then expecting them to learn. It doesn't work. We did some research recently that found that 30% of children think they would have done better in their GCSEs if smartphones hadn't been allowed in school. That's a third of children, which I just think is so sad. You know, there's something really simple we can do. Just give them a brick phone. They can call you on the way to school. That's all they need. And all of these problems will be taken away. We don't need to go to court to, you know, fight Meta. We need to do that anyway. But the simplest thing is just give them a brick.
Is there any evidence to suggest that if you take a phone away from a child at school, they then make up for the lost time for all of those bings and bongs and vibrations and all that dopamine-releasing stuff when they leave school? I mean, go home for the day.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, and studies have found different things. Some studies have found that they do, and others have found that they don't. And actually, there was a study that came out from the Netherlands last week where the children were asked just that question. They said, no, we are not making up for it in the evenings. And I think the reason for that is because your brain, if you give your brain just a bit of a break, you know, what some people call dopamine fasting, so you just stop that little checking cycle that we're all in, your brain just goes back to a kind of slightly healthier sort of, you know, way of being, and so then you're not trapped in that loop when you go home. So yeah, lots of anecdotal evidence to say that they're not, and head teachers have said the same. So I think that's really interesting, and what it shows is actually getting phones out of schools, it's not just supporting the school day, it's actually supporting childhood more generally, and perhaps, you know, family life, because let's be honest, this is the biggest argument that any family ever has now, and it's really sad. You know, it's not what we want to be having to be doing with our kids.
Very good to talk to you, Claire. Thanks so much for your time. That's Claire Ferniehoff, the psychologist and behaviour change expert, founder of Generation Focus, a group campaigning to keep smartphones out of schools. Now we're going to take a short break, and then we will check in with our US correspondent.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
The biggest multicultural demonstration in UK history has taken place against the far right, but does its rising popularity cause you concern? And it's 30 days since the Middle East conflict began. How can another 30 be avoided?
Richard Spur at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
The Paramount Plus spring sale is on, with over 60% off Paramount Plus. Sign up to stream every episode of exclusive shows like the critically acclaimed hit Landman, brand new series The Madison, starring Michelle Pfeiffer and Kurt Russell, and new Yellowstone series Marshals. All for only $2.99 a month, only on Paramount Plus. But hurry, offer ends Tuesday. Standard monthly plan only for eligible customers. Saving when compared to the full regular monthly price. After 2 months, auto renews at $7.99 a month unless cancelled. 18 plus T's and C's apply.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas, and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
At Lidl, treat yourself to a whole Easter lunch for eight for under £1.60 per person, with all the tantalising trimmings. That's a leg of lamb, carrots, potatoes, parsnips, mint sauce, and of course, the gravy. Lidl, more to value. Subject to availability, selected stores, GB only. See lidl.co.uk/vendless for details.
The all-new, all-electric Toyota CHR Plus. Sleek, stylish, and quietly reliable. Available with 0% APR representative, with £1,500 deposit contribution, and save £1,500 with the electric car grant. Get that Toyota electric feeling. Visit your nearest Toyota centre. Price from £34,495. Available on Toyota PCP when financed through Toyota Financial Services by 30th of June 2026. Optional final payment. Indemnities may be required. See website. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Right, let's get the view from abroad. Dave Ross, former presenter for KIRO 97.3, is joining us now from Seattle. Hello, Dave.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Long time no speak.
Yes.
Now, there was a No Kings rally in much of America. Did you get one in Seattle?
Yes, we did. We had several in Seattle. I live in a place called Mercer Island, which is an island suburb in the middle of a lake, just a mile away from Seattle. And it's connected by this, I believe it is still the world's longest floating bridge. It actually floats on the lake. And the demonstrators took their flags and their banners, and they lined the pedestrian walkway across the entire expanse of the bridge as part of the rally, along with a big rally downtown, which went to the Space Needle. So it sounds like they had another huge turnout yesterday.
Yeah, because it's not the first of these events, is it? Are they getting bigger? Is there a way to determine whether that's happening?
It's hard because there are so many, and of course, that estimating crowd size is fraught with potential errors. But I'll tell you what the main issue is for me. I'm sure a lot of people feel very empowered by this, by having so many others join them in this protest of the Trump administration. But of course, what determines who runs the government is the election, and the election turnout in this country has been terrible. We consider a 60% turnout to be pretty good. But the reason Trump is in office is because a whole lot of people who apparently now don't like what he did didn't bother to vote last time.
Yeah.
So if these rallies translate into a better showing at the polls, then they mean something. If not, it's just, you know, a walk in the park on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, well, we have the same problem in this country. But what the rallies of the type that we're talking about actually do is bring younger people out, and those are the ones that are hardest to get in the voting booths, aren't they?
Yes, that's true. And we try to make it as easy as possible here in Washington State. We're a mail-in ballot state, so everybody who is registered gets a ballot in the mail, and you fill it in, and you either pop it in your local ballot box before the deadline or put it in your mailbox. And yet, here in Washington State, where we're completely mail-in for all ballots, a good turnout might be 70%, but typically it's like 60, 50, 40%, depending on the election.
Even if they don't have to leave the house.
Right. That's what bugs me. In other words, I counted one election, how many ballots it was hundreds of thousands. People looked at the ballot, saw their name, saw it was their chance to vote and choose their leaders, and they tossed it in the recycle bin. and then they get angry when things don't work out. I've always found it very discouraging.
Yes. Was there, apart from being anti-Trump, is there a central message to these No Kings protests, or is it very sort of disparate?
No, I don't. It's organized by a place called, I think it's called Undivided. I forget now, but there's no specific agenda. There's no specific leader. It simply seems to be an outlet for people who don't like the idea of a president who thinks he can do anything without being checked by Congress. But the truth is, he can, because we have a Congress which is pretty much in his pocket. I mean, the idea of having the three branches of government was to check unbridled power in this exact situation. Mm. But there's nothing in the Constitution that says they have to, right? they have the power to if they want to. But the House of Representatives, the Senate, and to a certain extent the courts have said, go ahead and do whatever you want.
Yes. If certain agreements were sort of done as a gentleman's agreement, and if it wasn't written down and it is not specifically forbidden by law, then people used to not do these things because it was perhaps embarrassing. But there's enormous power in being without shame, apparently.
That is exactly. I think you put your finger on it. We used to think that, for example, that's the role the press would take. The press would unearth some sort of scandal, like, let's say, the highest officer of the land personally profiting from investments that he can directly control because he's the president of the United States, right? That's really against the Constitution, and any news outlet would, you know, that splashes out on the air, the guy you think would be so embarrassed, you just resign and slink away. But you're right. There is tremendous power in being someone who just doesn't care what people think. And that's where the votes become important, because voting is one way you can enforce the Constitution by kicking out people or refusing to put in people who clearly don't abide by its rules.
And up to now, Republicans seem to have voluntarily removed their spines and just flopped in front of Trump and begged him to use them as a floor mat. But that's changing now that there's a war on, isn't it?
it's dividing the Republican Party because one of the things that Trump ran on was no foreign wars. It was America first. But now he is justifying this and basically saying, well, look how easy it went in Venezuela. Now we control their oil and maybe their whole country. Iran, lots of oil, choke point in the Persian Gulf that's always been a perennial problem. If we can take that over, then you'll see oil prices drop. In the meantime, I'm paying, I think down the street, it's now $6 a gallon. I mean, I'm used to maybe three or four, but not wow. six. And that's the kind of thing that gets even Trump supporters riled. Now, I thought my guess, just having, you know, watched the guy for all this time, he knows that winning solves everything. So if he somehow subjugates Iran and we get to occupy Karg Island and we get to determine who goes through the Strait of Hormuz and suddenly oil prices plummet, then he becomes a hero and all this is forgotten. If he gets dragged into a war with American boots on the ground and we start seeing casualties and, God forbid, you know, they unleash terrorist cells in the U.S., then he has a real problem.
Yeah, well, it seems as though he does have a real problem because the Iranian regime are much more resistant to attack than he was. I assume that it's that Trump was led to believe by the sycophants that he has surrounded himself with who fear perhaps telling him the truth.
Well, the Pentagon's always got war games and they've got plans for every scenario, right? And somebody told him, hey, we can disarm Iran. We know where all their missile sites are. We know where they refine the uranium. We know where they manufacture the missiles. If we bomb all that stuff, they're toothless, and that solves a bunch of problems. It ends their support of terrorism against Israelis and in other countries where they've exported terrorism. And I think they sold him on this idea that if he just sticks with it for the next few weeks, few months or maybe a few years, then Iran is completely removed as a threat. But the clock's ticking here. And not just $6 gas, but the fact that they can't fund the security checks at the airports, that the flight controllers are having trouble keeping planes apart from fire trucks on the ground, things like that. These are all beginning to chip away at his veneer of credibility.
Yeah, well, the Pentagon did actually war game this precise thing in 2002. They called it the Millennium Challenge War Game. It was America versus mm-hmm. Iran. And I'm sorry to have to tell you, Dave, Iran won. And they went ahead and did it anyway. Dave, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks so much for that. That's Dave Ross, former presenter for KIRO 97.3, joining us there from Seattle. I'll be back on Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. If you missed any of this show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, both of which are free from your app store. Coming up at 4, it's Ian Payne. But first, here's Richard Spur.
Good morning, Nick, and good morning to you. On the way, 500,000 people have rallied in London against the far right in what was the biggest multicultural demonstration in Britain's history of that sort. The Alliance event, A Stand Against Politics of Division, included a video message from the Mayor, Sir Sadiq Khan. I'll be asking if the rise of the far right in this country's politics is giving you cause for worry. But first, it's now 30 days since the US and Israel began strikes on Iran and started what is now seemingly developing into a broader Middle Eastern conflict. But with Donald Trump's apparent lack of any specific aim, any specific strategy or plan for that campaign this morning, what must now happen in order that, in another 30 days' time from now, you and I aren't still sitting here looking on at destruction still taking place?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock.
It's expected a meeting between the Prime Minister and business leaders later will focus on the Iranian blockade of the Strait of Hormuz shipping route. Sir Keir Starmer is due to host a gathering of figures from the energy, shipping and financial services industries at Downing Street. Speaking to MPs 7 days ago, he said the government thoroughly understood the gravity of the situation.
I've been really clear with the team that we mustn't fall in to the sort of false comfort of thinking that there will necessarily be a quick and early end to this. We have to plan on the basis there may not be. In terms of energy has been where a huge amount of focus has been. On energy supplies, I can reassure the committee that we haven't any meaningful concerns about energy supplies.
The Chancellor is due to warn the G7 group of nations they must act together in the face of the economic uncertainty being caused by the war in the Middle East. Rachel Reeves is due to say any move towards protectionism would create new threats for energy security. The price of oil has risen again on the overnight markets. Brent crude has already hit $115 a barrel following weekend attacks by the Iranian-backed Houthis operating out of Yemen. The United Nations has announced one of its peacekeepers has been killed in Lebanon. It's also saying another was critically injured when a projectile exploded in the south of the country, although it's unclear where it came from. On Sunday, Israel announced it would expand operations in the area because of continued missile attacks from Hezbollah. Ali Risk is a Lebanese journalist and an expert on the group. He's been telling LBC the IDF may suffer in the south of Lebanon.
They are trying to address this issue of Hezbollah by taking more enemy turf, but I think that's going to prove rather costly, and I think